Welcome back to the Soundtracker Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peacock. So we're kicking off year three with another group of return guests. I had a lot of fun doing BAPS with David and Charles. And, this is a much bigger jump in movie quality wise coming to The Nice Guys, which I genuinely think is one of the funniest movies of the last 10 years. And I don't need to say anymore. It's a great movie. This episode's a lot of fun. You're going to have a lot of fun with this one. Check out the Patreon, www.patreon.com/soundtracker. You can get 28 bonus episodes and two more going forward every month. I started changing things up a little bit, by the way. I'm doing, instead of just two movies, I'm going to do a movie as a bonus episode and then something that ties into one of the movies that I did that month. So this last month, I did a Goofy movie. And then because I had done two Disney movies, I did a top five Disney movie thing with George, who came back from the Lion King episode to do that with me. So check that out. It's www.patreon.com/soundtracker. And as always, give the show a rating wherever you listen, Spotify, Apple, any of those places. I would really appreciate it if you would. So here we go. Kicking off year three, The Nice Guys. Enjoy.
No use running, ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs, the soundtrack, I'm gonna track you down!
All right, everyone, welcome back. So I'm getting to a movie that I've wanted to do. You know, there are movies like Zodiac. When I did Zodiac, Desi and Rachel kind of said it's not like a soundtrack movie, even though the soundtrack is hugely important. It's not when you think of the soundtrack. And this is kind of one of those two. It's a period movie, and it's just absolutely one of my favorite movies of the last 10 years. I'm doing The Nice Guys, and joining me are two very nice guys themselves. I'm joined by the host of the Hostile Witness podcast, Charles Starr, and from Defector Media, I'm joined by writer and co-host of the Distraction and Christmastown podcasts, David J. Roth. How are you guys doing?
Hey.
All right.
Nice to be back. I was so happy to watch BAPS again and to discuss BAPS again. I'm yep. looking forward to doing that one more time.
People loved it. And so we were like, why not do another one?
Yeah. That episode was extremely popular, honestly. I'm shocked. it did numbers.
That is absurd.
Well, I mean, it was posted on a Landau forum.
Well, okay. So this is funny. This is where I usually ask again, just like last time, I usually ask like what.
Sorry, it's a phrase Landau forum is kind of getting my ass right now. It's in the r/Landau.
I usually ask the guests why they chose this movie, and this is kind of like, it's weird with you guys because the last time Charles chose BAPS, David, you've been fucked over by Charles, but you've gotten dragged into this the whole time. But I figured this time I wanted to have you guys back. I wanted to do The Nice Guys. You seem perfect for it. And like, this is like kind of like an olive branch for making you watch BAPS. We get to watch with The Nice Guys. Yeah.
We're square. I feel like this is it. You and me are good.
No, it's, and Charles, you had never seen this prior to.
I had not. This was a gift. Like being, because it's a movie that's been on my list, and I don't watch movies really. Like I just don't watch a lot of movies because it's a 2-hour commitment, and with all the sports and everything and whatever, I just don't take the time. And so, like when it's assigned to me, I appreciate it.
Well, this is such a, you know, I watched this maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago. It was before we had like set this up that we were going to do it, just on a whim. It was on Netflix and my girlfriend had never seen it. And so like, she tends to watch these with me. And I'm like, when I'm doing for the show, and I was like, oh, it's The Nice Guys. We just watched that. And she was like excited. Like, oh my God, I'll watch that again. You know what I mean? It's like that. Yeah. It really is that kind of movie. But, well, I'm excited to do it. Let's do a little bit of background before we get into the actual talk on the movie. So we kind of talked in DMs about how this movie got fucked at the box office. So here's step one and why it got fucked. In the United States, the film was scheduled initially for June 17th, 2016, but Warner Brothers moved it up to May 20th so they could give its previous date to Central Intelligence, the Kevin Hart, The Rock movie.
Oh, Christ.
So The Nice Guys premiered May 11th in Hollywood. It screened at the Cannes Film Festival on May 15th, and it was released in the U.S. in theaters May 20th. It was very quick turnaround. Came out to critical acclaim, sits at a 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. Unfortunately, that didn't lead to a strong box office. It opened in fourth place with $11.3 million. It eventually went on to make $62 million back against a $50 million budget, which, again, unfortunately, nowadays, you've got to basically double or triple your budget to cover the whole cost of advertising and everything else. But it's become a cult hit because of video and streaming in the time since. I mean, I've never met somebody who disliked this movie, I guess is what I should say. You know, I saw this in theaters and I was shocked that it didn't do well because it was a pretty full theater. And like it, every beat worked with the crowd that I saw it with. I mean, the big laughs when there are supposed to be big laughs, like it was a really fun theater experience.
Yeah. So,
here's the top 10 the week that it came out. If you want to know what it lost to, number one, the Angry Birds movie.
Okay, not a lot of overlap.
Make me mad. Children's
movies don't count.
Yeah.
Number two, Captain America Civil War.
Same thing.
Number three, Neighbors. Now, here's where they say, so I'm not joking, this is considered the reason Nice Guys didn't do as well, because they had similar demographics, at least according to industry insiders, I guess. Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, the sequel to the Zac Efron, Seth Rogen movie. And then number four being the Nice Guys. Then the rest of the top 10, The Jungle Book at number five, Money Monster at number six, number seven, The Darkness, number eight, Zootopia, number nine, The Huntsman, Winter's War, and number 10, Mother's Day. So honestly, not a very good top 10.
I've never even heard of one of those.
Which one?
The one before the Darkness, maybe?
Money Monster?
Money Monster. Never.
Money Monster is amazing. I've not seen it, but it's like, it was one of those sort of misbegotten Hollywood attempts, like someone other than Tony Gilroy trying to make a Tony Gilroy movie. It's got like, I think George Clooney and Julia Roberts are in it. And George Clooney, I think, is playing like kind of a Jim Cramer type character, which is perfect casting, if nothing else. I mean, you get to have him roll up his sleeves and it's pretty much the same guy.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, they is apparently a disaster. Like, I mean, it's just like kind of funny anytime Hollywood's trying to make a movie about, especially, you know, talking about it in this current context with some of the most laughably evil executive behavior we've ever seen. Like, of course, whenever they make a movie about how greed is bad, they're going to be like, okay, well, let's start at the start. Like, just, it's not a natural movement for them. They don't know how to do that shit.
Yeah, I think out of that top 10, the only ones that I've seen are Captain America Civil War and Nice Guys, I believe, are the only ones that I've seen in that whole top 10. So
I was going to say that I know a lot of people that, not to brag, that love this movie. You are the only person I know that saw it in theaters. I don't think anybody like, and it was supposed to be good. And people like talk a good one where Shane Black is concerned. Like, he's a guy that's had this whole reconsideration as a, you know, not even like as an auteur or whatever, he's only directed a few movies, but as like, a, you know, a voice, a screenwriter. And yet, like, I really do, I don't know, like, I'm not going to beat myself up for having let down The Nice Guys, a studio comedy with two big stars in it. But we were talking about this before, like, there should be, they set up a sequel for this movie. There should be four of these.
Oh, I know. In a just world, there would be. It's funny going to theaters. Like, I have these really weird where I'll just like get a hot nut to go see a movie where I'm like, I want to go see a movie right now. You know what I mean? And if somebody can't go with me, I have no qualms in going watching one by myself. And this is one of those ones where like, I went and watched this by myself. And like I said, it was a fucking awesome experience because just being with a crowd that was like super into it was, I mean, it really did. It made, I told everyone I knew about it afterwards. Like, you got to watch Nice Guys. It's so good. I did my part.
Good for you.
On behalf of the Jews, thank you.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I guess we did come out okay either way. You know, obviously, Money Monster didn't work out. Angry Birds, huge success for us. So,
all right. So a little bit on the production of this one.
We're allowed to make those jokes, by the way. It's fine.
Yeah,
right. I can't. That's why I shut up. I just laugh. Yep. I'm sitting here and laugh. I don't even know if I'm allowed to laugh. I'll tell Ross to cut that out. It's complete silence.
Give you the J pass for the rest of this episode.
Kind of a mixed bag, I'll be honest.
Right. Congrats.
if you find new eggs, right.
here's a crock pot full of pot roast and the Communist Manifesto for some reason.
Oh shit! Okay, so like Shane Black's previously, the film he directed previously, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. This was taken. The inspiration for this was from a novel by Brett Halliday called Blue Murder. I actually looked it up on Goodreads after this. It's only got like 6 ratings on Goodreads. So it's not like this was like a big series, but like, I don't think anybody's read them in years. They're old like dime store sort of mystery novels. But he wrote a version of the script in 2001 and it sort of established the characters, but it was vastly different. So according to Black, each would start with one detective and he with March and his writing partner, Anthony Bagarossi, started writing for Healy. And along the way, they swapped characters and eventually wrote a first draft off of what the other ones wrote. But the version that they wrote didn't attract any buyers. And so Black reworked it into a 64-page version that was going to be a television pilot. And CBS wanted to do it. They were looking into it. But given the contents, they thought it would be there a lot of objections by standards and practices. So
yeah,
it didn't progress. And later on, Black said the whole idea of doing it as a TV series was stupid. It wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have been any good. I'll come back to that point in a little bit. But by 2009, Bagarossi suggested changing it from a contemporary setting to the 70s, because originally it was a contemporary movie. And Joel Silver was wary of this idea because he thought audiences wouldn't be as welcoming to a period piece. But after he produced that
kind of prescient, I suppose.
Yeah, right.
Well, the funny thing is, you
got to put that one under the W column too, I guess. But you can do.
Well, the funny thing is, what made him change his mind was he produced that Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr. And then he was like, okay, well, we could do a period piece. And so they drew from films like Vanishing Point and Five Easy Pieces for inspiration, and they sent the scripts to Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe, and both wound up taking the role, especially for the prospect of working with one another. They were like really excited to work with one another. And Gosling even stated that when he read the script, he read it already picturing Crowe as Healy. And to him, reading it that way, the movie just immediately became so funny. It was his exact quote, because he had never seen Crowe in a role like that. And, so they accepted within 3 days of getting the screenplays, and Black said that their casting is the reason the film even got made. So he said after 13 years, it just popped into place in 3 days. And so for the look of the film, Richard Brigland, the production designer, did the best to recreate the 70s. So he researched Super 8 films from documentary photographs, basing furniture on designers such as Werner Panton. Even Misty Mountain's glamour photography had him recruiting Arnie Freytag, responsible for most of the Playboy centerfolds of the 70s. And for its part, Warner Bros. Used the 1972 through 84 Big W logo designed by Saul Bass to open the film, which I'll come back. I'll talk about that when we get to the movie too. But in August 2018, Black did reiterate his desire to make a sequel, although he said it probably didn't gross enough box office to make it happen. Now, when I said I would come back to the television thing, I didn't know this, and it looks like it's got to be a dead project now. We're talking 6 years later. But in 2017, Fox gave a script commitment to a contemporary female-led version titled The Nice Girls, to produce by Silver Pictures Television, which, again, it's got to be a dead project, but it's just pretty funny given what Shane Black said about this being
a if it's not, I'm protesting it.
Yep.
that's all the production stuff. Just a couple little trivia pieces, and we'll talk about the movie. So when promoting his program, The Loudest Voice on the Howard Stern Show, Russell Crowe said this is one of the two films that he's made in his whole career where he wishes there a sequel because he liked playing the character so much. The other was L.A. Confidential. During March's monologue about, and I missed this even last night, but during the opening monologue about the downturn of society that March is giving, the porno theater in the background is playing a movie called Bang Bang Kiss Kiss. There's a lot of little Easter eggs like that in this movie. One of the nods to the Rockford Files is the Yellow Pages ad for Holland March's detective agency. It's almost a complete copy of the ad used for Jim Rockford. And much like Jim Rockford, March keeps his gun inside of a cookie jar. So like I said, there's just so many little things in this movie.
Also, much like Jim Rockford, he gets his ass kicked nonstop throughout the film, which is a delightful bit to borrow, for sure.
Russell Crowe.
It also just is... I mean, I guess we'll get to more of this later, but the thing that struck me was it's noir, and it's like really, really noir, but there are like a million sight gags. Like it's a fucking Zemeckis
movie. Oh, yeah. It's and incredible. It's
such a great pairing.
Yeah, to do a story like this that's like a kind of, you know, if you strip away a lot of it, like a downbeat detective, you know, like a Chinatown-y sort of like vibe and trajectory to the narrative. And then it has like 30 Rock joke density. Like, I didn't even know that that was an option. Like, I feel like that's ordering off the menu, but like that is actually the type of shit that I want. Like, that's the movie that I want movies to be like.
That's I love when you juxtapose two genres that seem like they would not go well together and pull it off. You know what I mean? That's the best thing in the world when you can pull that off.
Yeah. And I mean, it like that is like Chinatown is the exact same thing I had in my notes, because like the smog in California is a stand-in for the water stuff in Chinatown. Like it they really just do overlap in ways that just shouldn't be happening in this movie.
So Russell Crowe put on extra weight for his role in this movie, because when he read the script, he figured that he should be like a stocky brawler type. So he put on, I don't know how much, but he put on extra weight for the movie. This is something I didn't know about. I'm too young for this, I guess. I was born in 1980, but this isn't necessarily like, it's just a detail in the movie, but there was a sign at the fuel station that says even. Did you guys know about this? There was in 1979, there was a fuel rationing that they had
for vehicles. Everyone hated Carter.
Okay, see, I didn't know about the even thing. That's something I didn't know that they did. So I might be a big dummy in not knowing that.
I knew there was rationing. I didn't know that there was that was how it was done.
Yes, it was.
So even. It was basically like if your license plate number had like even numbers on it, you could fill up that day. And if it had odd, you could do it another day.
Yes. Sorry. I walked that back. I knew there was rationing. I didn't know the process is what I meant. Yeah. Like that it was. Yeah. So like, if the day was April 3rd and your license plate has 827, you can fill your car that day. So, and some states allowed even an odd numbers on the 31st of the month. I did not know that was how that whole rationing program worked. It seems kind of insane to me that it would work that way. Like you're out of gas on a Tuesday and you can't get your fucking gas filled till the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the desperation, the idea that there was a contemporary set version of this is like oddly very difficult for me to imagine. I guess just now that I've seen the 1977 version two times, like it doesn't seem like it would work if this were set in 2016 somehow, or at least it wouldn't work as well. I mean, I'm sure people are good at making these sorts of movies. I'm sure it would have still been a delight, but the setting and the time is, I mean, they get a lot of gags off of it, but it's not just there to sort of like wink at and nudge you. And like, everybody's got bigger lapels than you've seen, before.
I like setting movies in this time because it answers the question, why didn't they just call? You know what I mean? Yep. Cell phones and internet connectivity really blow up a lot of like interesting plots that are based on the fact that communication is like genuinely difficult.
Yeah.
Like there can be mistakes like that.
I just did Kids not too long ago, and I hate that movie, but I did Kids, and that's the whole point is that Chloe Sevigny's character is trying to find Eddie, whatever his name is, to let him know that he has HIV, and like that's the whole like whole plot, but like that's part, and it's like if they made that now, she could just call a cell phone. You know what I mean? Like that.
She would just text him dying. LOL.
Yeah.
Fire emoji.
Yep. Mr. Krabs meme with the word got AIDS on it.
And then two last things in the elevator scene, the girl from Ipanema plays in the background, which is a nod to the Blues Brothers. And again, didn't put that together. That's the song they're playing in the elevator in the Blues Brothers. And this is one. Now, I don't know if either of you knew this. I had no fucking idea, and I couldn't even tell last night. Do you know who plays Sid Hatrack in this movie?
No, you never see him alive, right?
It's Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I saw that there was an uncredited Robert Downey Jr. appearance, and I watched it twice in a week, and I looked for him. And didn't see him. So I was going to say that just because I didn't spot him. And I was like, oh, now that you mention it, it's probably Sid Shattuck.
Yep. That's so. Wow. All right. Well, let's talk.
It would have been really impressive if he was the kid on the bike.
Yep. The way as you've never seen him.
Yeah.
Misty Mountain.
He lost a lot of weight for the movie. Yep.
All right. So I talked about the Saul Bass WB logo is like, what a choice to use that, because I've said before that, that is probably my favorite studio logo in history. Like, I think it's just so fucking cool looking anyways, but like, you know, you think about when you see that movie pop up, when you see that logo pop up in any movie you've ever watched, like you're about to watch a movie from the 70s. You know what I mean? So like it, and plus we got Papa Was a Rolling Stone playing over it as it's building into the movie. And it's, I mean, literally with those shots of Los Angeles and everything, you feel like you're watching something that was made in 1977 as you start the movie, which is a really good foot to set off on if you're doing a period piece.
Yeah, which is very funny. I will tell you, I watched it the first time. I didn't force her to sit through it twice, but the first time I watched it with my wife, and the music comes on, she goes, oh, is this set in the 70s? And I was like, I guess so. And then the title card comes up and it says 1977. Yep. And we're like, well, it's not a lot of ambiguity.
Well, we got that one settled. Great. All right. Well, now we can just enjoy the movie because we know when it's set.
Well, and so one of the things, you talked about the noir aspect and the comedy mixing well, but another thing that Shane Black has always been good at is either writing or directing action sequences. And you even see that from the beginning. It's not an action sequence per se, but the way that Misty Mountain car crash is done is so well shot. Like, you know, the kid steals that skin mag, and in the background, you see that car come rolling down the mountain. It is just, it's not like, you know, it's going to come as it goes careening through his house. And, you know, one of the few complaints that I heard about this movie is that the whole thing's a MacGuffin, basically. Like, it's not a MacGuffin. That's the wrong way to put it. People who think that like the mystery itself doesn't resolve in a way that it should, but like, I don't know. I like the way it plays out, but it does kind of set up like there's going to be a little more intrigue than there is with that beginning where, you know, Misty, you know, laying there dying, just like she looked in the magazine and saying, you know, how do you like my car, big boy? And it almost sets up like it's not going to be a comedy because there's that sort of darkly sweet moment where he covers her body while she's laying there. So like, I can see people maybe being disarmed the first time they watch this, not knowing that it's like a fucking comedy.
Yeah.
Seeing that opening scene and thinking you're about to see a serious sort of noir film, but like, I don't know, give me a fucking break.
It works, but it is definitely discordant, right? Because the kid pinching the skin mag and then the headlights kind of bounding down the hill before the car blows through the house is legit hilarious.
Yeah, visually it's just very fun.
Right? And then he goes and you see the license plate, so you know that it's her. And then she's just lying, like, it's a visual callback to the pose in the magazine, but it's really fucking morbid. Like, it is not, you know,
that's not a gag. It's not a laugh.
It's not, yeah, it's not a bit. Like, it's like, it is meant to like recall the shot, but she's covered in blood. She's spitting up blood. She's clearly dying, you know? And so it is really just sort of smashing the noirness of the movie into the comedy of the movie in a way that you would think prepares you, but never really does, because they really don't do the really heavy noir again until they kill Amelia.
Yeah.
Like, well, it's gag, but the real noir pieces are really the buttons of Misty Mountains and Amelia dying, mm-hmm. like at each end of the movie. And so like, I don't even find it objectionable, but it's kind of weird in the middle of the movie that both of the scenes are like that, like playing those kind of deaths, not quite for laughs, but for absurdity.
Yeah, it's strange. I can almost see that complaint in terms of the plot or in terms of the satisfaction it does or doesn't give, because it's, you know, part of the fun of these is always like, discovering stuff, you know, like the process. It's like why they've made movies about detectives for as long as they've been making movies. It's fun to figure shit out. Like, they don't do a great job. Like, that's like sort of one of the overarching jokes of this, is that like, they are behind the entire time. They don't execute necessarily very well. And there's not a whole lot to like sort of hang your hat on in terms of being like, well, yeah, he's a drunk, but he's a damn good detective. Like Holland Cross is a drunk for sure. Not a great detective. Like he's like a B minus detective when he's on. He's an innings eater. Like he is not an ace.
Right. And well, and I mean, they really, really lean into how functionally corrupt he is.
Yeah.
You know, just always trying to get another day's work, like to the point where his 13-year-old has figured out his charging pattern.
Yes.
You know, where it's like, well, you do nothing for 2 days, then you make something up and get another installment paid.
Yeah.
Well, and I love the introductions to the characters. Like, first of all, I like that it swaps between their narrations. Crow has like a really great narrator's voice, but just, you know, it's him bitching about kids these days and checking on his 14-year-old. And I love how he's just like throwing pistachio shells in that kid's car before he goes in and kicks the shit out of him.
Yeah.
Also, yeah. Jackson Healy is a great hard-boiled detective name. Like, that is a fucking tremendous name for a character if you're trying to do like you learn a lot about him too with that line, marriage is buying a house for someone you hate. Like he's got that extremely divorced guy anger.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then of course we meet March in his tub in a suit. They're just like, again, perfect intros for these characters. And like his daughter is like the grown-up in the family.
Oh yeah.
And you know, you get the characterizations too with like him having "You'll Never Be Happy" tattooed on his hand. His wife died, he turned to drinking. Can't follow on follow through on things. He's like basically fleecing old women for money. I mean, he's just a true scumbag. And like the first thing you see is him taking a lady who thinks her husband's dead, her dead husband is missing, and he still takes the case. Like he realizes where she hit, where her husband is on the fucking mantle.
One of the things that I loved about that, by the way, is the easy joke is that her husband is missing and he spots the urn on the mantle, right? You're like, okay, that's, you know, I kind of figured the joke was going there because that urn is Chekhov's gun, right? It's blurry, but it's definitely going to be your husband, right? But they went the one extra step when he's like, when was the last time you saw him? Because she says the funeral. Yep. And then the next thing you see is him tucking the check into his pocket. Yep. You know, it's like, all right, well, now I know what we're dealing with. This one's paying for my kid's college.
Just a little bit of extra care in the jokes is like, yeah. I think that's exactly right. That Charles is like correct in that that is like a little bit better wrought than it needs to be. It also, again, like shows you where the priorities are. Like, I guess the plot more or less holds together. Nobody cares that much about that.
Right.
That's not what the movie's about. It's not like meticulously plotted. It's not the sort of thing where, you know, there's like a fun detective story. There is, you know, fun enough or whatever, but like the gag is not since the funeral. Like that is what they care about. And that like they fucking nail it. Like, I think that that's just, you know, if that didn't
set up who his client is before you even meet, you know, Misty's aunt. Right.
Yeah.
Like that's who hires him.
Yep.
You know, someone who knows him finds these old people who have inscrutable, unsolvable problems. And they're like, here you go. Take some of their money. Yeah. Like those are his Glengarry leads.
Yeah.
It's right. Someone who's like, these are exploitable women.
Yeah.
Go exploit them.
You're in your last 20 minutes of seeming like a pleasant young man. Like, go ahead and get that paper while you still can.
Well, and the thing is, even though Healy, I mean, of the two, there's no question that Healy is like the better, like big air quotes here, but like better person. But like, even he, when he gets that money from Amelia, you know, he tells her she's $7 short. Like he's like haggling with a girl who's like 15 years old or whatever, and is worried that some guy is like stalking her because she's $7 short. And I realize a job's a job, but you know what I mean? Like he's not as bad as March, I don't think, but you know, he's not a good person either. And again, why the title is so funny in this movie, that they're the nice guys, but they're the worst people you've ever met. I also love
it. Also, the movie also does a good job of surrounding them with people that are significantly worse than them.
Right.
Like, yeah. Inarguably and instantly identifiable as worse.
Right. They're bad. Yeah. There's a difference. Like they're not evil. They're just bad people. You know what I mean? Like, and they're surrounded by evil people. It's kind of their thing. I love some of the lines in this movie. I'm not going to do like a line-a-rama thing here, but there are certain ones that I've obviously put in there. I love like when Gosling's narrating and he says, "My wife used to say I make a living off of Rumpy Pumpy." Whatever, she's English. I don't know what the fuck she meant. Like, it's, right. It's such a funny line. And him offering that bribe in an origami shirt is like one of those.
The dancing shirt was like, I assume you've seen Game Night.
Yes.
And the scene where they're trying to bribe Chelsea Peretti and the guy is like, you know, he starts off with a 20 and then the denominations get smaller and smaller. So he's like sliding a second single across until Sharon Horgan has to just take out $100 bill or whatever.
I'll tell you.
And what. I was just like, that's got to be the best bribery scene. And then he pulls out this little origami shirt and starts dancing it across the bar. And I was just fucking crying, yeah. You know, and the bartender's like, "Is that a shirt?"
Yeah. That's what, I love the bartender saying that. It's so funny. I'll tell you what, Game Night's a very funny movie. That's a really
Game Night's incredible.
Movie. Yeah, it's great. So I'll tell you the moment that I knew I was all in on this movie. I'm like, I'm going to laugh thinking about it. Like I fucking laugh every time I watch it in the movie, no matter how many times I've seen this. I was literally like screaming, laughing in the theaters, but the whole theater was, is when Gosling punches the window out.
Yeah. And so this is, and that, which is immediately following. So basically the sequence for the people that haven't seen it is he's trying to get information from a bartender, using origami as his method. Does not work. That's not a spoiler. You probably already know that wasn't going to work. And then the next scene is him being like, sometimes as a detective, you have to like take matters into your own hands. And he tries to break in and instantly just opens an artery.
It's the classic scene, right? Where the guy wraps a towel around his hand.
He's
to
clearly
punch
doing
the glass.
A shitty and then, job. So you're kind of squirming because it's just like a couple of tissues or like a pizzeria napkin wrapping it around his fingers. You're like, no, don't. Please
but
don't
no,
do that.
No matter how you slice it. Like he punches the glass and you can see like literal mountains of glass still in the frame pointing directly at the center. And then everything is red.
And there's that like the noise that like there's like really good blood spurting sound effect in there too. Yeah. And like the way he's like, that's a lot of blood. And then it cuts to him. And when it cut to him in the ambulance is where I really fucking lost it. Like,
I mean, he stumbles down the stairs and falls into the trash.
It's also the beginning of what is a recurring theme throughout the film, not in a filmic sense, just in terms of Ryan Gosling does a lot of high-pitched screaming in this movie. Every time it was 100% success rate for me, which is embarrassing in some ways. And it's like, it should not get old or whatever, but it's like, yeah, I've heard it. Like every time he's startled, he does the Homer Simpson sound. But like, yeah, 100%. It just like it worked every time he did it.
Yeah, I mean, there are a bunch of things that like recur throughout the movie. Like every time there's gunplay, right? Every time there's gunplay, someone off screen catches a bullet and falls off screen. Yep. Right? Like when Blueface, you know, we'll get to it, I guess, sequentially, but when they have the fight where Blueface shoots, he kills or just shoots one of the neighbors, Jackson's neighbors. And then when they're having the you know, shootout at Shattuck's place, they kill the giant tree. You know, like every time someone in the background just catches a bullet and disappears, you know, like unlike, you know, every other movie where there are like, you know, entire bandoliers of bullets just shot in crowded spaces and no one hits anything. Every time someone takes a bullet and goes down.
Which is one of those gags that works me like one of the hardest laughs I've gotten in a movie too is in Pulp Fiction when Ving Rhames tries to shoot Butch and hits that lady in the back of the leg in Pulp Fiction makes me laugh every time it happens too. Gosling. Okay. So like Russell Crowe's very funny in this movie too, but he's more the street man. You know what I mean? So Gosling, I'll tell you what, as soon as I found out he was doing another comedy in Barbie, like I don't give a fuck. I'll watch Barbie just to see Gosling do comedy again because he is so unreal in this movie. Like I never expected, It's one of my favorite. I mean, just there, we'll get to the parts that just kill me that he does it. I'm like, I would have never expected this out of Ryan Gosling. But
because we're kind of on the scene, the one, like the punching the glass was incredible. But the one thing that really, really got me was he's being wheeled out of the hospital by a nun. And, you know, she's just asking him, like, you know, are you looking for, you know, have you found Jesus or whatever? But while it's going on, he's still delirious from either his drinking or the loss of blood or whatever overdetermined reasons that he's completely delirious. And he takes his hat off while he's kind of stammering and tries to put it on the nun's head. Like he's just wearing like a Dodgers cap or something. And he just tries to put it on her head. And, you know, she just very calmly takes it off and puts it back. And it just feels like Gosling just had this kind of very funny, inspired moment with someone who has two lines in the movie, you know, and just kind of improvised this really fucking dumb moment that is just supremely funny.
Well, and for his part, Crow, like there are moments in this part we're talking about too, where Healy get some very funny bits too, where you get to see him kind of doing like hammy shit. And like one of them is when they did the cutaway of how his marriage ended. And she just says, I'm fucking your dad at dinner. And like his reaction is so good.
A two-tiered spit take, which I had never seen before.
And it's like, that sounds like something that would happen to Gosling's character.
Yeah. right.
Meanwhile, Gosling's character's wife died in an incredibly tragic house fire.
Right.
Like the comedy guys, like the one with a kid, his wife died in a horrible way. And the other one lost his wife to his dad.
So Healy showing up at March's house and roughing him up is Gosling is such a little weasel in that scene. Like he just like flinches every, and he's like trying to crawl around and like, you know, he's
hitting the Homer screams hard there too.
Yeah.
And like, I love to, he immediately rolls on his client and Healy's like disappointed. He's like, you just gave your client up without me, like without anything. He's just like, look, her name is so-and-so. And
well, but what I think is funny is like, he never really had time to explain, right? Cause he's like, what's really going on is March, in a way, if given the opportunity, would have explained, I'm not actually looking for your client. I'm looking to find out if your client knows the person I'm looking for, right? Because all he knows is that he's figured out by running the plates that Amelia is where this woman thought she saw the now clearly deceased Misty Mountains, right? That's the kind of one of the underlying mysteries, is that he has figured out that Amelia was where she thought she saw this other person who we know to be dead. And so he doesn't even get to say that, even though he's starting to say it, because he reaches for the gun in the cookie jar and Russell Crowe brains him. And then he goes for the gun like two more times, never coming particularly close.
But I was going to say, progressively less dignified attempts to his own handgun.
He's like crawling on his stomach at the last time. And I love his when he tries to fight back against him breaking his arm. He's like, no.
Yeah. It's like, right. It's just really, really impotent begging.
And we meet Holly. Holly's a highlight of this too, though. She's so good in this movie. Yes. And I'll tell you what, every time I watch this movie, I want Yoo-hoo. I want to go by a Yoo-hoo every time I watch this movie. But yeah, you know, she was hanging around the vacant lot, which you find out later on is where their house was that his wife died. But I always forget that, you know, Keith David, as many times as I've seen this movie, because Keith David's in so many fucking things, you know what I mean? But he's just, Keith David is like the best. If you want a character, he's so versatile as like, because he's so good at playing a character like he is in this, where he's like a shady scumbag. But you know, there's plenty of movies where he plays like a funny, nice guy too. And It's so funny. His associate's name in this is only named Keith David's character's name is Old Man, and the other guy's name is Blueface. That's right. Their names. They don't have character names. But yeah, they knock out Healy, and they cut to Marsh trying to explain to his client that Misty's dead. He shouldn't have taken her money. And again, this is another one of those scenes where she pulls out the checkbook and he immediately 180s. And that part in his car where he goes in and he's like to his daughter, "Let me ask you a question. Am I a bad person?" And like before he can even finish the question, she's like, "Yes,
of course."
The guy that plays Blueface is an incredible weasel henchman, by the way. Like, just
yeah, he hasn't really worked that much after. I mean, he works all the time, but he hasn't like had another turn like this. But it's just such a classic type of character to have in this type of movie too. That he's just like he's repellent in three scenes. Like a little bit scary and like funny, you know, in how repellent he is. It just seemed, I think of Nikki Katz's performance in The Limey as being like another good example of this, like a way to like sort of steal three scenes in a movie that's got like a really pretty focused story as a supporting character is just to be like super oily and like condescending to everyone around you in an unearned way.
The guy who I kept thinking of, especially because it was like a 70s thing, was I kept thinking of the bad gang leader in Warriors.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like that guy. Plus, he kind of shrieked, you know, his laugh was kind of like Dr. Doom.
A giggler. Bo Knapp is the actor's name. I wish him well. Like, put him in more shit. You shouldn't just have to do SVU episodes.
He has a bit of the I don't remember which the one of the weasels in Roger Rabbit has a very similar way.
Yes, yeah. The weasels even more than Doom. That henchman laugh is very weasels.
Yes. And he gets his name obviously from the exploding ink that Healy tries to tell him not to open the bag, and you just see that blue shit fly out. And I love Healy's getting so mad that he's killing his fish. You know what I mean? Like he's still in a spot where he knows better. He knows that if he like were to just try to beat the shit out of this guy, they'd shoot him. But he just like tells him like, I love how he's like disappointed too. He's like, "Is this why you came here to come here and eat my, to kill my fish?" But he, you know, tells him like, "You've made an enemy today," and he causes enough of a distraction to get the upper hand. And that's where you get that really funny bit where he fires blindly at him as he's leaving the apartment and hits that fucking,
some poor neighbor lady out the window. Yeah.
But my favorite scene in the movie is right after this. My favorite scene in this whole movie is the scene where Healy confronts March in the bathroom.
Yeah.
It is the shit that Gosling is capable. Like, we dropping the fucking cigarette in the toilet, looking between his legs, trying to hold that fucking door open as it keeps bouncing with his arm. Like,
because he's got to hold the magazine over his dick.
Yep.
And he's got to hold the gun in one hand, and he has to keep an eye on him through the stall door. And he just plays this game of like castanets with the stall door just popping open and closed, where he's just trying to hold on to it. And that's like what I mean, like by just like out of nowhere, a sight gag. You know, I mean, it is incredible.
It's extremely broad too, like, and not in a way that I objected to in any way, but it was like surprising because it is not, it's in the same way. He has another one when they discover Sid Hatrack's body, where he does like basically like Laurel and Hardy shit, like weird gasping sounds and points. Yeah. Which is like, it's a real, I'm assuming, you know, like it's a movie, like you actor goes to a director with his choices and the, you know, they pick the one that works best. It's just funny to think of like Ryan Gosling, like brooding star that he was at that time, being like, I thought I'd play this one as if I were a cartoon.
Cowardly lion-esque.
Yes, exactly. Right. Like I want to make some cowardly lion sounds in here. Yeah. It seems like something my character would do.
Yeah. And I mean, he is like beyond shit. His character is like beyond shit faced in that scene. You know, like he tries to flirt with, you know, the Pocahontas lady wearing the Chief Strongbow you know, headdress. And then pitches himself over and tumbles, you know, all the way down the hill. And that was like another one. Like they did the lighting with the Robert Downey thing, where every time he clicked on his Zippo, you could see the corpse behind him, you know, until he found it. But like that, there were that as good as the stall door scene was, it was my second favorite sight gag in the movie. Because my favorite was when he gets a call, you know, figuring out that Amelia is at this party. And he asks Holly to hang up the phone and she just drops it. Yep. Right. Like the cord is stretched like across two rooms and she just she's like, no,
it does not have time. Doesn't say anything.
She just drops it on the chair.
Oh, there's so many good little bits in this. What I mean, the way the bathroom mirror thing, or the way the bathroom thing plays out too, where he's like, he's still trying to cover his dick and he's like, look away, and he's like, you know, there's a mirror here, right? Like, close your eyes. Like, he's just so worried about Healy seeing his dick in that moment is like just incredibly, incredibly funny.
Really good work from Crow in that scene too. I mean, it is like, he is the straight man in this, but it's basically, it's a great idea. The idea of basically like taking his character from LA Confidential, stripping him of his badge and any professional authority that he has, and then just having him take the same approach, this kind of like violent, wounded child, like wandering through the world of fucking people up and being fucked up in turn, is a great bit.
Except
it's
just this time
it's a less overt thing.
Right, except in L.A. Confidential, he never has a reason to laugh. And in this, he has to keep a straight face through this like complete bumbling idiot of a partner who keeps literally falling down drunk in front of him.
Well, I like, too, where they like set up their partnership. One of my favorite lines in this, too, is when March, he's trying to get March to help him. And he says, what, do you want me to finger her so you can throw acid in her face? Like, it's such a funny thing. I'll tell you what, there's one joke in this movie that doesn't land. And it's when his daughter confuses rim job for rim shot, only because I don't think rim job was a term in 1970s.
Yeah.
But I like the bit where they're talking to, and he's like, Ryan Gosling's trying to the nice porno lady when he's talking about Misty Mountains, not a porn star. She's a nice young lady, the nice young porno lady.
There's so many of those types of jokes, which I'm a sucker for because it's just, it's extra dialogue. It's more words, which is, you know, my personal like preference whenever there's an opportunity. There's a couple of those at the party, like him chastising Holly to not say and stuff.
Yep.
Unnecessary. She's like,
that running gag is one of my favorites.
And stuff. And he's like, don't say and stuff.
Don't say, no. She goes, this party's got a ton of whores and stuff. And he's like, don't say and stuff, Holly. Just say there are a lot of whores.
Holly, what did I tell you? Don't say and stuff. And then later when she's like, Holly has to say, don't say and stuff. Just say they wanted you to do anal. Like, it's so funny. How it
comes. Which is funny because I actually think the and stuff is appropriate there.
Yep.
Because that's another one of the like really great. I mean, this one's a little bit more heavy handed, but when they first arrive at the party and you see two women, you know, sort of walk, you know, stage, you know, like in front of them in the camera, and you just catch the snippet of dialogue. And so I said, if you want me to do that, then don't eat the asparagus.
Yeah. What? I like how Holly immediately thinks Healy beating the shit out of people is like cool as hell. You know what I mean? Yeah. She's like, just like, yeah, that's, but Gosling or March being a scumbag too. He takes Healy's money for 2 days worth of work, even though he knows where Amelia is already. He's like, I still get paid no matter how long it takes me to find her. I know where she is right now.
And was trying to negotiate for three.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, we can't leave that scene without, especially in light of, you know, her trying to get Healy to beat up Janet, is when all of the people were yelling their shoe sizes, because they're at a bowling alley for Holly's birthday. And so all the girls are yelling shoe sizes. And he's like, Jesus Christ, one at a time. And Janet is like, you took the Lord's name in vain. It's like, I did not, Janet. I found it very useful.
Yep. Yeah. That's just Billy Wilder shit. Old timey, ancient Hollywood gag right there. Yeah. But I love it. Just a real nice 1, 2, 3.
Yep. And that protest for Smog too. And I love how Gosling shows up and he just points. He's like, she's in there somewhere. And when he keeps saying that's her protest group, stop saying that. I want to stop saying that. But the protesters won't break character. Fuck you, man. We're dead.
Yeah.
But the part that gets me every time in that is Marge just stepping on that girl's fingers when he's walking down the stairs. It's so fucking funny. Like, for no, just again, his
Healy fucking with their symbolism, right? Because they're all in gas masks.
Yeah.
He's like, so those masks didn't save you?
Yep. And they find Chet. I love how angry March is every time he talks about fucking Chet. He just hates that kid immediately. But yeah, they take him to where Amelia's boyfriend is. That's where we start to set up a little bit more of the mystery, though. It's like the house burned down. Her boyfriend died in this house. They were filming a porn there. And that kid rides his bike by and, says that the Misty Mountain was at the house. The producer's name is Sid Hatrack. And I like how Gosling's like, no, his name is Hatrack. But the whole thing with the kid asking if they want to see his dick. Nobody wants to see your dick, dude. Yeah,
there's a bit in there where Gosling has a great little bit where the kid's like, he charges him $20. And then, like, tries to up the rate as they're leaving. And Gosling's like, I already said no to $20. What am I saying? Why am I talking about this right now?
But the movie they were making was called How Do You Like My Car, Big Boy? So that comes back to Misty Mountain's last words. And he sees what the kid met by Hat Rack, names Sid Shattuck. He sees him on a billboard. So they had to talk to Sid Shattuck at this huge Beverly Hills mansion party. And Holly tags along in the trunk. September, I know we'll talk about it when we get to the soundtrack, but the song uses in this movie when they're utilized are great. Like, September is such a great song for that scene, you know, like they're just kind of waiting this party. And again, March can't smell. Like, we find out something else about March, that he has no sense of smell. And I love that scene too, where he's like, looks like Mary Jane came to the party. And it's just like such a, like, a cheesy thing for someone to say, you know what I mean? Oh, looks like Mary Jane. Mary Jane showed up to this party. And this is where Healy splits up, leaving March to get completely fucking hammered. Now, one of my favorite, I was just thinking about this the other day, that he's having that killer bees discussion, which was such a 1970s and 1980s fear. Like, do you remember there were like TV movies about killer bees and shit when we were growing up?
Yeah, that was one of the things, by the way, that, you know, like, it's another thing where, you know, you watch a movie twice and then you see the things that you missed the first time, like the foreshadowing. The headline in the paper that he's reading when he's online for gas at the beginning of the movie is about the killer bees.
Oh, right? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, it's just the headline. He doesn't say anything about it, but then the bees become a recurring thing through the movie. And when they're in the house, it's just like it's either him and Holly, or maybe it's on Healy's television, but there's an episode of The Waltons on.
Yeah.
You know, like these things that they sort of just drop in there and they just seem random at the beginning. And even you don't even notice them when they come back later, but they were kind of there just as like seeds for referring to later in the movie. To make the references sound normal.
But they paid everything. It's sort of similar in some ways to, I mean, the movie has a lot of, I think, resonances with The Big Lebowski in general, just in terms of it being like an LA noir with an unsatisfying story and a ton of gags in it. But it's in the same way that I think Big Lebowski is made more, I have to pay Bill Simmons $5 for saying this, more rewatchable than it would otherwise be, because they like close every circuit. Every gag you get once, you get again in some sort of little callback, not in like an obnoxious way, but in a way that makes you feel like the filmmakers and the people that are involved in making it are all just cracking each other up with how much fun they're having.
Yeah.
That like that, it's endless how many times you can watch it, because like, not only are you picking out new stuff, then you're waiting to see it again. You're waiting to see like the track listing on the back of the Autobahn record, you know, like it's all. Yeah.
I mean, Lebowski has like the, you know, get it, the biggest to me, get it the second time of my life, which is, you know, and thorough.
Yes.
You know, like he goes to see the doctor And the scene right after the doctor's office is him like in the best mood of his life in the car, you know, singing along to the radio, banging the roof.
It's the Creedence tape.
Yeah. Right. You know, and like, maybe I'm crazy. Okay. But the second time or third time, or I don't know how many times it took me to get it. And I was like, oh, the guy jerked him off at the doctor's appointment. That's why he's in such a good mood.
I always assume he jerked himself off. I guess I didn't think about the doctor being the one that did it.
You know,
one way or another, he's experiencing a moment of post nut Credence clarity.
Yeah.
Is happening
that didn't click until like a million times watching the movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, did everyone else get this immediately? Because it took me a while to realize just how, the scene ends with the doctor kind of like
putting on a rubber
dropping glove, low. Right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I'm like, no, the doctor jerked him off.
I'll probably not in the fun way that this movie does, just in the annoying way that I do when I'm on podcasts. What I feel like this movie, what was stolen from it in terms of, obviously it does have this cult, as Eric said, you know, the people that know about it love it and recommend it to other people. It is the sort of movie that would be cultural glue in the same way that The Big Lebowski is if it just ran in a lightly edited version on TNT back to back to back to back to back all through a weekend. The way that like it was like built to do, like this is, it can stand up to that kind of rewatching. And yet like it didn't, either because it didn't hit at the box office or because of the fact that we just don't do that anymore, that right. There's not like new cultural products being let into that club. It's just like fucking,
and people don't watch TV and leave,
or people don't watch TV, I guess.
Yeah,
right.
That's a big thing. Because this is one of those movies, when we talked about this in the direct message DMs, I compared it to like back to back with Roadhouse, because it's like that type of movie that if you've seen it more than once, you could pop in a half hour in and be like, I'm just going to finish this from where I started. You know what I mean? Like it is that type of
movie. Or like know where you are and do the like ordering a la carte thing. I do that Step Brothers movie I love dearly that is in that club and does get rerun all the time. And it'll be like, I can figure out where I am in that movie relative to like, has the little kid taken his solo on the car sing along to Sweet Child of Mine yet? Or like, how close are we to the Catalina wine mixer? And like in both of those instances, like I will choose to watch. I'm like, oh, whatever. We're like fucking 5 minutes away from the Boats and Hoes video. I'll just sit around for that.
Step Brothers is so fucking funny. Yeah. Because the next part is where we already talked about, you know, him falling off the balcony, blah, blah, blah. But one part that we didn't talk about that fucking makes me laugh so much is when he's all drunk down at the bottom of the hill after he falls and he sits down to light the cigarette. And it's the way he delivers that March, he's our man. If he can't do it, no one can. March is so, it is such a funny drunk guy thing to do all by yourself at the bottom. Like,
yeah.
After nearly killing yourself falling down the hill.
Yeah.
Because you were trying to impress a pretty girl.
It's just so good. But yeah, so Sid Shattuck's the dead body, so this means everybody who was involved in the Amelia porno is dead or dying. And I love how Healy is so disappointed in him too for falling down the hill drunk. And that leads to probably the most funny broad joke in the movie is when they toss Shattuck's body over the balcony. Yes. And it lands on that fucking dinner party down below. It's just one of those like, you didn't need to add that joke, but thank God you did.
Yep. It's, yeah, killer shit.
It's so good. We get into a little bit of like what I talked about. This is where we get to see where Shane Black is good with action. You know, Holly gets in the car with Blueface. Healy runs into Keith David. There's that big fight. And then again, this is where you see Black's way with action come in through these scenes because they are well-staged action scenes. That fight looks great. It's like a knockdown drag out, you know, him shooting him when he's trying to drown him and he shoots him through the pool. You know, Blueface is, there's all this shit going on, you know, Blueface trying to shoot Amelia. March finds out she's in the car and chases them, completely fucking shit-faced.
Which, by the way, that was like as good a sight gag as you'll see. Gosling steals a sports car, goes peeling out, chases them, sees them, and does like the 180 to like turn around and confront them, but loses control of the car and drives right into a tree, you know, like just when it looks like it's going to be like a perfect Starsky and a Hutch kind of thing where he like turns around and jumps out of the car. He just drives right into a fucking tree.
It's
and
edited
can't
and
back up again.
It's edited and timed so perfectly too. So there's just that moment where you're like, whoa, is he like, did he like drink so much that he became a good detective? And then like,
right.
You have just the time it takes to have that dumb right. thought before he plows a Corvette into a tree at top speed.
I like that Healy beats Keith David so badly that he agrees he'll move to, he's going to move to Michigan.
Well, he'll go back to Michigan. Yeah.
He's just
yeah.
going back.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. So Blueface corners Holly and Amelia and gets, and that's another like jarringly violent scene when he gets annihilated by that van. It's like one of those, like, it's not necessarily, it's not played for laughs at all. Like he gets fucking drilled by that van. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah. Though it is kind of a van ex machina, you know, like he, like it just sort of comes out of nowhere and hits him. And that's not even where the violence is. The violence is like off screen when Healy like smothers him to
yes,
death, right. like by getting Holly out of the way.
Yeah. And that's, I like that.
You know, Holly like that's just there. Another.
Cause there's yeah. that, there's that weird thing where he's yeah, like, the, almost more of a father figure to Holly than March is, you know?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
He's more together. And, but yeah, he definitely is like more attuned to like, is this child or, you know, whatever, she's like a tween or whatever, but like, is she going to notice me doing something bad? Whereas like Gosling is just balls out fucking up all the time. And so it's like not really a concern that registers.
Well, and right before Blueface yeah. dies, he says yeah. John Boy, who's coming to get them. Like, it's like, you know, Chekhov's John Boy. Like, but, you know, obviously we talked about this movie's hilarious, but there are moments, it needs moments like where March shows up and he gives Holly a hug, because again, there's no reason, like at this point, you almost think his daughter hates him. You know what I mean? But you see that she doesn't, you know what I mean? Like he's still her dad. But
they do have one. Sorry, I was going to say they have one consistent thing, which is every time he fucks up, Holly gets really mad, right?
Mm-hmm.
But every time it seems like he's got his shit together, even like the slightest bit, the camera shows her smiling. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the moment, you know, that he has figured it out. Like when he announces that he's decoded the message that it's the Burbank West Apartments, you know, who's the dumbest, whatever, before it gets undermined, she gets to be like, oh, my dad actually is a good detective.
Yeah.
For a second.
For like 1 second. Well, and like right after that scene is where he's talking to that cop and he says, you know, who else is just following orders? Hitler. Like, the yes. way yep. he's like, keeps like thinking Hitler is like all the Nazis. Like, and then you get the thing where Healy's recognized. There's so many jokes that, well, we've talked about this a few times, but there's so many jokes that pay off in really funny ways later on. Like when Healy gets recognized to the diner guy, which is not played for laughs when you get the story, but plays off in such a fucking funny way in different ways throughout the movie. But yeah, you get the diner guy. We get to meet Kim Basinger's Judith, Amelia's mom. And I love March being completely smitten with her assistant plays off so well later in the movie, like so well that he's just immediately smitten with her. And Basinger is this DA. She's famous for crusading against porn and the auto industry. And Gosling like trying to like, yeah, porn is bad. Like, you know, he's like trying to play along because he's trying to impress everyone in the room.
Well, no, but even but at first he's, you know, he's like, what stuff are you into? What do you watch?
Yeah, it's like, he's going whichever way he thinks the wind is blowing.
Right. Like, you know, he's prepared to have a conversation about porn, pro or con.
Right,
as fulsomely as he can do it.
and he undercuts the check that she's gonna write him. She's writing $10,000. He's like, how about $5,000?
Yeah, I couldn't do it for any less.
That was another one that took me two viewings. When they start that meeting, right, it's, you know, Healy and March go into Basinger's office, you know, this big mucky muck from the Department of Justice, and she just says, would you like a mint? And Russell Crowe gives him a nod, which
is like,
you stink of alcohol, dude.
Right. Like, he's still loaded. Crowe has like some great face acting in that too. He's just kind of like,
and he like takes the mint, like 4 or 5 mints, and he eats them almost like Cookie Monster. You know, like they don't all quite get in his
there, okay, so there's a part in Bad Santa when Billy Bob Thornton is trying to put gum in his mouth and he's too drunk to do it and like drops down his beard, and it's that same deal. Like, it's such a funny sight gag, somebody who's too fucking drunk to even get something in their own mouth. It's like one of those really funny bits to me. But you know, this is where Healy tells the diner story that he was a big hero, and Gosling's like, I love when he starts to tell the story and Gosling's like, it's the best story I've ever heard, man. And then he's like asleep 30 seconds later.
Yeah.
But yeah, Healy finds Holly in the lot, you know, and they find out that March never fixed a leaky furnace because he can't smell. And Healy can't admit to her that he killed Blueface even now. And this is, again, right when everyone's about to give up on him. You brought this part up earlier, but where you think you're seeing that March is a good detective, because in that note, he's like, it's not for flight. It's for flat, not a flight. And then he's wrong. Yeah. It builds up to like, oh, again, like you said, it's like where you're thinking this is the moment here. This is where it turns around and he becomes this good detective. And he's just, once again, he's completely fucking wrong. And right.
they drive to the Burbank West apartments, and it's like a coming soon sign and a vacant lot.
Yeah.
This is like the place.
This goes back to, like, I think the central, like, joke of, like, the under joke of the movie, which is that, like, the both characters are persistently frustrated in their attempt to, like, be the hero of the story that they imagine themselves in. And so for Gosling, his idea is that, like, he, like, is like Popeye with spinach is like him with like McAllen, and that like the more he drinks, the more he like clearly sees through stuff. He's never right. And then Crow, as you said, with like, looks like Mary Jane showed up at the party, which you mentioned earlier, Eric, it's like anytime he tries to be like fucking Sam Spade or like some classic detective who's got like some hard bitten, you know, metaphorical way of speaking, everybody's like, shut up, that's stupid, don't say that. He's got, like, the one where he's like talking about, you know, there's like two ways of looking at things or whatever, and Gosling's like, just say that, like, yeah. I don't need to follow you through this whole story. But it is like, just the ways in which every character is brought up short in those scenes is like thematically really funny, and then every time they twist it, they give it like a little bit of extra spin on it, so you're appreciating that you're seeing it again, and then also appreciating that you're seeing it in a slightly new way.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Nixon story is the one where he's like, so you're telling me there's two ways to look at everything, why didn't you just say that then?
Yeah.
Right.
So they find out that Amelia's in this high rise. They go to this bar, you know, and the bartender tells them, and March confusing Munich and Eunuch is another one of those really funny jokes.
Yep. Just,
but there's that massacre going on when they get to the floor that Amelia's at, like, just people, I mean, it's like literally like a professional assassin is killing. Yeah, all
the John people. Boy is going off up there.
Right. And again, hilarious facial acting on Gosling's part when they show him there. There's like that straight on shot of the two of them riding the elevator down, and that corpse goes, that guy goes falling out of the building beside them, and Gosling's like, his eyes twitching.
he's shaking like a chihuahua in winter, man. Like, Crow is just totally stone faced, and Gosling's whole body is quivering.
Yeah.
And they're lucky to find. It's so good. And like I said, Gosling, like, I would love to see him do more comedy, but like, I would just love to see him be able to do March again. Like, I would, God willing, we get a sequel to this at some point. Stranger things have happened, but March, you know, wants to abandon Amelia, but Healy wants to help her, and they get lucky. She lands on the car, and that's a very funny pratfall too, that she shoots at them, and that they kick back from the gun, knocks her off the car, and she knocks herself out. So they like bumble their way into getting Amelia. And they get back to March's. Holly's there with Jessica, and you know, Amelia comes too, and she says her mom is the criminal, and she's not working against the auto industry. She's on the take. The porno they were making was going to blow the whistle on all this. And I like, March just cannot comprehend the idea of them putting a message in a porno. He just cannot wrap his mind around.
It's like, so the point is the plot. Is that what you're saying?
Just the commercial aspect.
The commercial aspect is like, when she says that phrase, that she was like, she wanted to make an experimental film showing that the auto industry was stopping the catalytic converter. But Sid Shattuck said that they needed to have porn in it for the commercial aspect.
And then Tally calls, and March just immediately gives up Amelia despite everything he just heard.
Right.
Because he's horny.
With the weaseliest little guys in the history of cinema. We love to watch him.
And like,
she said she packed it herself.
Yes. Yeah. He just cannot believe it. And so, yeah, Tally gives him that package. They did deliver $10,000. Now, this is the beginning of what I consider one of the funniest long payoff jokes that they come back to, is the dream sequence while he's driving is so fucking funny, because yes. It's like, I remember seeing this in the theater and being like, this is like a surreal little part we're in right now. Cause he's driving and he's like, hey man, don't you know you don't have to drive? Just take your hands off the wheel, and like shows him his ankle holster, which is what sets up for the joke that I think pays off so fucking funny later on. But that killer bee's in the back seat, and that's when I was like,
Hannibal Burris's voice, I think.
Yes, you it are was. Correct.
Yeah.
The way it just immediately cuts to Healy yelling, "Wake up!" It's so.
And then they hit the impact attenuators, water splashes everywhere.
Yep.
And then, you know, like you get another Lebowski like thing where you know, like the briefcase explodes and it's all, you know, paper, not money.
Yeah. And so it's, and again, like you said, he can't believe that she said she packed it herself. But John Boy shows up. I'll tell you what. Matt Bomer does a really good sociopath.
Like, we love Matt Bomer. Matt Bomer is, I think that's probably part of why my wife watched this with me. I swear that she enjoyed it. She does not remember it at all. But we're a white collar household. Like I'm a Bomer guy. I think he's neat. And it was great to see him be like, cause he's the most handsome guy in the world. So watching him be super creepy and sociopathic and wear like the glove that like hitmen wear in movies like this is all like, it's a delight. Like another thing sort of turned on its ear in a fun way.
Yeah. I also think like another very understated joke is he shows up at the house under the guise of being the family doctor for Amelia. And he's obviously just going to kill whoever Amelia is. And the first person he sees is Holly's friend, Jessica. And who's like clearly like 13 years old. And he's like, that her?
Yeah.
Like that's it. He's about to just drop this 13 year old.
He's got like a dinner reservation in 15 minutes. And he's like, can we just, I'm gonna use a silencer to kill a person. Just tell me who that is.
Well, and so Jessica's the one who fucks up by asking, because Holly sees him through him immediately, and Jessica asks
about the guy she sees the big mole on his face, which was a John Boy thing.
Right.
Like that's how she realizes that he's the John Boy, is that he has the big mole on his face, like the character on the Waltons.
Yes. And so, yeah, there's the big shootout. Jessica gets thrown through the front window in a very violent scene for a 13-year-old getting just
shot
through that window. And, yeah, he comes out shooting at Healy in March. Amelia sneaks out. And, again, like I said, great shootout. Great mix of funny and exciting. Like, the part where March tosses the gun way over Healy's head trying to toss him the gun. He's like, throw me that gun.
Right through the window, like- too. Just smashes through the window and is now outside the house.
But John Boy, you know, they chase him off and he gets – so it goes from funny to he sees her and he's just like, what does he say? He's like, what are the chances or something like that?
He says, wow. No.
Yeah. Wow. Cause she's just like right there and plugs her right in the head. And they treat this scene seriously too, though, which is good. I mean, it's not treated for laughs. You know what I mean? Like it is where these two have bottomed out at this point. Like the one thing they were supposed to do is keep Amelia alive. You know what I mean?
Right.
And they couldn't do that. And so, yeah, March's lawyer tells them they're fucked, basically. No one's going to take their word over the DAs. And Misty's aunt, holy shit, what was
that? That was a horn outside my house.
Oh, okay.
It's very different. Usually it's sirens.
I recorded with Blaine Kapach last month, and he lives right above a firehouse. And so, like, two times during the episode,
we don't know. There's a chance that this is going to become unlistenable for at some point during this.
We had to stop twice. Misty's aunt shows up, says she saw Misty in a blue pinstripe jacket, and this is when they realize it's a clip from the movie. So they go to Misty's and find the hidden projector, and what she saw was the movie being watched, and it was Amelia watching it. So there's a copy somewhere, and Chet, again, Chet name gets brought up, and again,
can Chet
Mark, like fucking Chet, the plans to play it at the Los Angeles Auto Show. And I love after all of this when her sweet aunt is like, does this mean my niece is dead? And March is like, yes. Immediately realizes that it was too much. He's like,
well, I mean, not just realizes it. Holly and Healy just look just at him with contempt.
Come on, dude, look.
What is wrong with you?
So they go to the auto show, and Tally, again, just as, the whole thing with March, god damn, Tally finds one points a gun, and March is too worried about how she looks. Like, he refuses to believe that she's bad. And like, he even says, that briefcase you gave us didn't have any money in it. Like, she didn't know. And Healy, I love too when Healy tries to, Healy's doing the hard-boiled detective thing where he tries to psych her out. Listen, lady, have you ever killed anyone? And she's like, yes, three people in Detroit. And he's like, really? Yes.
And then Gosling's like, you're not a killer. Yeah. He's like, she just said she killed three people. One, you know, one you just can happen by accident. By the time you get to three.
But you get the payoff that I'm talking about when March drops down to the ground and tries to get his ankle gun that he saw in his dream is such a, because like, by that point in the movie, if you've only seen it for the first time, you might even forget that the ankle gun was part of the dream sequence yourself. You know what I mean? Like, you've gone far enough away that you might be like, oh yeah, he carries an ankle gun. And then like, you almost like along with him are like, it's just, it is such, and Healy's like, did you dream that? And he's like, oh, I did.
What you get before that payoff, though, is more Ryan Gosling just being a worm, just being a just an odious little imp of a man, like crawling around on his tummy, patting Russell Crowe's ankles in increasing frustration.
Yep. And then you get one more sight gag. Holly comes in with a room service cart and splashes coffee on Tally, but of course it's cold. It's been sitting on the room service cart in the hallway for hours. Right? It's not being delivered. It's like, it's the dregs. And so she just gets dirty and then slips on the coffee and knocks herself out.
Yeah. And he's like, well, that really worked out. So they split up again. March gets bar detail. John Boy finds Chet, takes him aside, and I love March is trying so hard to be good at the bar, and then he hears free drinks and his ears perk up.
Yeah. So well, that's a recurring theme too, but that's why he got hammered at Shattuck.
Yeah. But I think even at Shattuck, you like, he was ready to drink. You know what I mean? Like, he was gonna drink even if the drinks weren't free, but that's just the further enticement. But yeah, Healy finds Chet, tells him the porn sliced into the real film. John Boy already knows. Keith David grabs him. They find March, or Holly gets grabbed by Keith David, and they find March, who's drunk and scatting at the bar, which is so funny. Like, again, he's not actually, but you think that's what's going on here. Like, he's like sitting and doing scats at the bar. And all this, and again, the final action sequence is really good. There's a fucking ton going on in this sequence. You know what I mean? You've got March and Holly on the roof, and March, you know, stayed sober. You find out he stayed sober, and he kills Keith David. And that fucking awesome shot of both of them falling off of the roof and Gosling landing in the pool and him splattering on the ground in the maroon suit, which also leads to that really funny bit when Healy's like, I don't think I can die. I think that's the
ultimate
I think I'm invincible. Because Healy's like, did you fall off the roof this time?
Yeah, this is like the second time that he has fallen from a great height in the film and miraculously survived it. Like,
and you got third time he's been like soaking wet.
Yes.
Like, he started in the tub, he went into the mermaid tank, and now he falls from however many stories right into the pool. So he's always in his clothes wet.
Well, and all this is going on, John Boy's gone like full goblin mode. He's just shooting in the at the projector to shoot it out in the crowd. And March hiding behind the rotating car is fucking hilarious too. Yeah. He jumps behind that car, and it like, that's a really funny play on the guy hiding behind the car.
Right, because it's like, they're at the auto show, and so it's on a rotating platform.
Yeah.
Like, and so when he jumps out, he's like totally exposed and facing the wrong way.
So Holly tosses the film down, and you know, just as that, like, March is chasing the film, everybody's scrambling to get it. Healy's just beating the shit out of people. Holly catches Healy killing John Boy and tells him if he does, she'll never speak to him again. And March has his moment where his never on his you will never be happy has faded away.
Well, it's like it wasn't a tattoo, it was ink.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And so it's smeared.
It's smudged.
Yeah. Right, right. You find out then that it was just him. He had written it on his hand. And you have to assume he writes it every day because a few days have passed. Like, we've seen it. Right. But so Healy lets him live. March gets the film, and Judith, they meet with Judith, who tells them that she was just trying to save the America she loves. She wants to save the big three. And this is where, again, so you were talking about how this movie sort of plays with like the idea of like a Chinatown or something, you know, the ending of the movie. March meets Healy in a bar. Healy's drinking again. And, you know, they tell, it's like this very nihilistic ending, you know, like you would have in these old movies where it's like, yeah, we saved the day, but so-and-so is getting off, you know, kind of like shooting against corporate greed or just there's a lot of nihilism in these movies, you know? So like you're getting that here, but they turn it on its head by they're fine with it. Like they've got a PI service. They're going to drink and have fun. And I love too, when he pulls out that PI service ad and he's like, I'm sorry, you look Filipino. He's like, I do look Filipino.
Yeah. Well, I will say that ending was super funny to me because it's not just that Crow is drinking because he looks like shit and he's drinking straight from like a handle of whiskey.
Yeah, it's like right? A bottle of rum.
Yeah, it's like he's getting like, yeah, it's Captain, you're right, it's Captain Morgan. He's getting straight fucked up, drinking right from the bottle. And what he says is Gosling comes up and he's like, at least you're drinking again. Right. So it's not that Gosling quits drinking to be a good parent to Holly. The happy ending is that Crow is a drunk man. Right.
Their partnership, that's their partnership blossoming. It's like it's basically the equilibrium of like the guy that like more or less had it together and was like, you know, wanted to do good is now pounding captain at the bar without so much as a glass involved in that process.
And again, that this follows up like I said, that like it plays out like you're nihilistic, like, yeah, you know, nothing's going to change because of this. But like they don't give a shit because they're drinking. You know what I mean? Like that's what makes that land so well for me, too, is that like the character arcs, as you said, it's hilarious that the arc is that Healy becomes a drunk. But again, the happy that is their like bright spot in all of this makes that so much funnier to me that like they got nowhere with their investigation, really.
Plus, even if you think that maybe Healy can handle his liquor, they do the bad breath tie gag, which is very funny. And the way that Russell Crowe laughs at it is like laughing at the Three Stooges. Like, like he just looks drunker than Gosling has ever looked in this movie when he laughs at the bad breath tie gag. Yeah.
It's like,
and you're like, oh no, like he doesn't baby. Handle his liquor well at all. This is why he quit.
Right. It's like a baby laughing at a fart sound that a
yes.
Like it is not like an adult laugh. It's a baby's laugh, which is again that much better when it's coming from Russell Crowe, who at that point just looks like a baseball mitt in a Hawaiian shirt. Like it's just like as fucked as you can look.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good. It's a great movie. And I'm so glad we did this one. I'm so glad we talked about The Nice Guys because it is just, like I said, it's one of my favorite comedies probably my favorite comedy of the last 10 years. And it's like slowly creeping its way up into like one of my all timers. You know what I mean?
That Gosling's back in the game, I hope he'll do a sequel. Like, I feel like Crow at this point has entered his like, I mean, I don't even know exactly like what stage of stardom he's in right now because he's still like the guy above the title, but he's just like does B movies I think now.
Oh, so he can do this. I think all of them would do it in a heartbeat. The problem is, I mean, you just wrote this article, no one will pay to do it because no one's willing to take any chance. Maybe if in fucking AI writes A Nice Guys 2, they'll shoot it in the metaverse.
Yeah, but no, it does have that feel. And that's like, also, I had that moment when Eric was sort of running down the production history. Like, of course there was a moment where they almost made it a TV series. Like, it would be an excruciating TV series. It would stink.
Yeah.
Like, you could do it as like a poker facey type thing, I guess, where the episodes are an hour long or whatever, but like movies are different than television. Like it's a different thing. Like there is more craft involved in this. I don't want to be like a snob about TV or whatever.
Well,
because there is good TV, but it's like the storytelling demands are different. Like the amount of care that you can take is different. Like this should be a movie. It should be three more movies. Like I still think that they should be continuing to do these, especially if there are more books by this author that could be adapted with relative ease. Like,
yeah. I mean, if there's anything that says they could do another one, it's Knives Out and Knives Out 2.
Yeah.
Right. Is that like there is an audience for people doing that kind of, you know, comedy noir-y kind of thing.
Yeah. And this is so much leaner than that. I mean, that's the thing.
But what I'm saying, like, there is at least something between when Nice Guys came out and now where you're like, no, there's an audience for this type of, you know, combination of characteristics.
Yeah, if you had to sell it to, like, just some reptile lord studio head guy, that's the thing that you would point to as being,
right.
Like, yeah, like... people like this sort of thing when you do. And it's like, I mean, what's funny with the Knives Out movies is that somehow the last one costs like $200 million to make or whatever. Yeah. You're like, how? Like, where is that exactly? Like, is that necessary? Like, in this case, like, this should be.
And again, invented the COVID pill for them.
That was real.
Yeah, that was all R&D.
It could only be administered by an uncredited Ethan Hawke, or else it didn't work. But yeah, that was. But in this case too, it's like one of those things where, and this is real old guy yells at cloud shit. I already complained about how there's nothing new on cable anymore. But in this case, it's like I do feel like there used to be a worse version of this movie, a new one in theaters a couple of times a month when I was young. That there was like something, it wasn't always good. It wasn't by Shane Black. It didn't have like real top tier stars in it. But like, this is the type of movie that people like. It's not like at some point in the last 5 years, people decided they only liked movies where like Chris Evans stands in an airplane hangar wearing a motion capture suit. You know, like that's not like the only genre that people care about.
Right.
But yeah, like I would take, you know, whatever, 70% of this movie is still something I would watch.
Hi, everyone. So I'm back with another Patreon pitch, but something's changed this time. So I've been saying since the start of the Patreon that this is basically what's going to help keep this show going. And for people who might be sitting on the fence, I have something exciting. Patreon picked me as part of a test group to try free trials. So if you're someone who's been debating whether or not to get signed up, go to www.patreon.com/soundtracker, where you'll find my $3 tier, my $6 tier, and my $8 tier. The $3 tier comes with a 14-day free trial, and the $6 and $8 tiers come with a 30-day free trial. There's no commitment, and if you don't like it at the end of the month, you can cancel. But in that time, you can check out the bonus episodes and get a feel for it and see what you think. And if it's something you enjoy, hey, welcome aboard. But give it a shot. www.patreon.com/soundtracker. I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to offer this, but as of now, it is something that I can offer. And it's exciting, and I'm hoping that this gets more people to check out these bonus episodes because there's some truly great stuff in there, and more to come. All right, let's talk about the soundtrack. So, a little bit of background. John Ottman, who had scored Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, was brought into the music for the Nice Guys with David Buckley. He also threw together the soundtrack list. So he drew inspiration from 70 shows like SWAT, The Dean Martin Show, Streets of San Francisco. He detailed that the difference to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang was that the music was more song driven, and Black stated that he wanted the songs to contrast the neo-noir tone by focusing on mainstream exuberant songs of that decade. So Lakeshore Records actually issued soundtrack albums that featured both the music and the score, and the soundtrack got a special collector's edition vinyl by this company called I Am 8-Bit, and they created what they said in their words, something that seemed like it was an artifact from the 70s and drew from the fictional world of the movie to give you something that you can hold in your hands. And I've looked it up. There's like a gatefold with a 3D centerfold of Misty Mountains. The packaging has posters of Sid Shattuck films, business cards for the Nice Guys agency. It's out of print now, but you can find what it looks like on the Light in the Attics record website. And it's a really cool looking package for the movie, or for the soundtrack. But as far as the soundtrack goes, it released on May 13th, 2016. The top 10 the week that released. It's always weird when I get to the 2016 ones because I was pretty out of like what the hell was on the Billboard top 10 at this point. I mean, that's all stuff that I know. But, you know, number one was Drake's Views. Number two was Beyonce's Lemonade. Number three was Radiohead's A Moon-Shaped Pool. Number four was Keith Urban's Ripcord. Number five was The Very Best of Prince, because this was actually about 3 weeks after he died. Number six was Cole Swindle's You Should Be There. Number seven is Rihanna's Auntie. Number eight was Prince and the Revolution's Purple Rain soundtrack. Number nine was Adele's 25. And number 10 is Chris Stapleton's Traveler. So further down the chart, again, these are tricky for me because I didn't know. I just pick out three people that I recognize on the charts. Number 36 was James Blake's Color in Anything, which was where it peaked. At number 65 was 21 Pilots Vessel, which peaked at 21. And at number 89 was Major Lazer's Peace is the Mission, which peaked at number 12. But we're in the era where no one sold albums anyway, so it doesn't really mean as much. I mean, nobody's buying albums. So number one on this soundtrack was The Temptations' Papa Was a Rolling Stone. This was originally recorded by Undisputed Truth, and it appeared on their album All Directions. Less than 6 months later was when their version came out. So it was like a very short stop between the Undisputed Truth version and this version. Now, this is the single
version. That's a tough one for Undisputed Truth. Nobody talks about that. That's kind of a, that's a bad beat for them.
It is, because their version's really good too. Just not as good as this one. And the thing is, this is the single version, because the full length album version is 12 minutes long. And this, the single version was a number one hit, won 3 Grammy Awards. The full length album version was ranked at number 169 on Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums of all time. Now, I did know this friction arose during the recording of this song and that album, actually, for a number of reasons. The Temptations didn't like the way the instrumentation was getting more emphasis than their vocals. They didn't really like the direction the album is going, because it's a very different album than most Temptations albums. And they had to kind of press Whitfield to do a few ballads for it. There's the only reason there's like the Temptations-y ballads on there is because they relented. His treatment of the group eventually led to his dismissal as their producer. And legend has it that Edwards was angered by the song's first verse. It was the 3rd of September, that day I'll always remember, because that was the day my daddy died. And his father was said to have died on the 3rd of September. Now,
oh my gosh,
that's an old rumor. His dad died on the 3rd of October. It's still close enough, though. But so my cover song questions, is this song different enough to justify existing? Yeah, it's different. But did they fuck it up? No. And it's honestly, it's superior. It's the superior version. The Undisputed Truth version is great, but this is the superior version. The production on All Directions is incredible. But yeah, it's just, it's a grimier, dirtier sounding Temptations. That bassline is fucking incredible. It's a great song.
First thing you hear in the movie, and it definitely is like, if you've heard the song before, it grounds you in what you're about to experience in a way that is like cool, because the song is really good. But like, yeah, that baseline is like basically that plus the Warner Brothers logo, as you said. It's kind of a like a little like whispering let's go to yourself as you're preparing to watch a movie type of thing. Yeah, it lands.
Yeah. So up next we've got Kool and the Gang, Get Down on It, from their album Something Special. So there's a little funny thing behind this one. So I just did recently Donnie Darko with Bobby Big Wheel, and Bobby Big Wheel was on for Gross Point Blank. Both of those soundtracks had Echo and the Bunnymen's Under the Killing Moon. And when we did Donnie Darko, I said, in a first and 100% certainly last time for this show, the guest on this show did two soundtracks with the same song on them. Well, fuck me, I guess, because this was on BAPS. This is the BAPS to Nice Guys pipeline we're talking about.
Yeah, we need more. There should be more BAPS crossovers in this. Yeah. Like, I want to. There's no like wailing diva vocals like New Jack R&B. Which is a shame, I think, the movie.
Yeah, really. And this and this one doesn't have any Debussy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, basically the same thing I said during BAPS, like, this is a staple of any oldie station worth their salt. Like, it's a great song.
I mean, that's the funny thing, really. And I mean, we talked about this when preparing for the episode. It's just a funny soundtrack to talk about because you're just like, oh, look, another banger.
Yeah. Right. It's not like one of those things.
Like they all fit because it's a 70s themed noir. It is the good background music for the time, you know, like there's just stuff at the end that I actually have like actual comments about, but mostly I'm just like, yep, liked it.
Yeah. It's like the opposite of, there's that 90s trend with soundtracks. And Big Lebowski again is also one of these too, where it's like some music supervisor is absolutely earning their fucking paycheck. They're finding like album cuts off like Graham Parsons records that are like really dope and people don't know them. And those are in there. There's a lot of like Tarantino stuff that has that. Like, this is not that. This is like straight up like Jack FM. Every one of these songs charted top three. And like, it's a song that you know by heart, like, which, you know, it's like, I've read like pros and cons on like, you know, on the nose needle drops and TV. There is like more and more and more of that. And it is like corny when you hear it. Like, this is, none of this is like played for effect. Like, it is you know, quite literally the soundtrack of the movie. It's just like what is playing at parties or on the radio, right, or wherever these guys go. And in that way, it's like both fun to listen to these songs again for the podcast and also like exactly, you know, true to life, I imagine.
Right. I mean, it feels like it feels authentic in a way that like playing Single Ladies when the four women in 80 for Brady, you know, yes, are doing, yeah, the Pulp Fiction walk or something.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't know if that happened, but I wouldn't bet against it having happened.
Right. I was going to say, like, I think we all kind of know that that happened, even if we didn't see the movie. It feels, yeah. So there's, I guess that's the other thing too. Yeah. You got to, there's no like soy punchline with this music in the film.
Right.
So that's, and I appreciated that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Dave, you touched on something that I talk about in this next song here when you talk about it being, well, I'll get to it. So Taste of Honey's Boogie Oogie Oogie from their self-titled album. This was released as the band's first single in the summer of 1978. Topped the Billboard 100, Hot Soul Singles, Disco, Action Charts, became the first single certified platinum in the history of Capitol Records. So what I put on my notes here is this is the sort of stuff, and this is true of this entire soundtrack, that my local radio station plays, the Tiffin radio station, WTTF. It's like all you listen to when we're working at the farm, or it's the only thing I have on in my car, because it's great shit. Like it's the whole, it's like the sort of, because my station does, you know, all these used to be, and my station still pulls stuff out like this sometimes, where you'll get like old doo-wop or something, but like all these stations now are transitioned to like Motown or like AOR sort of stuff. You know what I mean? Like that's what you hear. And that's like what this whole album is. And this is like a prototype modern oldie station song. You know what I mean? Like this, and it's great. Like it has that Isaac Hayes guitar line, but then it kind of transitions into something like Off the Wall or something. And just, it's a great song. And like I said, it's a staple. All of these are like staples of any like oldie station that exists now that have kind of moved beyond the like 40s, 50s, oldies, and into like 70s stuff.
Poor Andrew Gold is like, yeah, all of them.
Well, my radio station plays that song all the time.
Nice. That's great.
Yeah, they're great. It's honestly, it's my favorite station around the area. But so yeah, number four, Earth, Wind, and Fire, September, from their album, The Best of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Yes, you know what? This is funny. This, I did not know this. This originated as one of those, here's a greatest hits album, but here's also one new song, so buy this greatest hits album song. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, wow.
But it was huge. It reached number one on the Billboard Hot R&B songs, number eight on the Hot 100, number three on the UK singles chart. It's a staple of their body of work. It's been sampled, covered, remixed, re-recorded. It was added to the Library of Congress National Recording Registry with songs that are culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant.
It is the bane of Demi's existence.
I was going to say, yeah, and it ruined the life of a poster that we all know and love.
He's on this song's Wikipedia page. They talk about Demi.
Yeah, good. Of course.
Yeah. But yeah, so Maurice White said that Allie Willis wrote this song in 1 month, and they were, this is funny, I did not know this about the song. Willis was initially bothered by the gibberish Badia lyric. White used used throughout the song and begged him to rewrite it. And he said, this is his quote, "I just said, what the fuck does Badia mean?" And he essentially said, "Who the fuck cares?"
Right.
He realized, though, listening to it laid down, that like, who cares about it, as long as it's danceable. And there are theories about the significance of the date. Maurice White says he claims that it was because he liked how it sounded. But his wife said that September 21st was at the time the due date of their son. So, yeah. Anyway, I did not know until doing the notes that he was saying Body Oz. Many times I've heard this song, I thought they were saying like On and On or something. I had no idea that was like, it was just like pure gibberish.
Oh, but I just thought it was like La 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 kind of background song sound.
I was going to say, it speaks to the importance of the who the fuck cares perspective on this.
Yeah.
It's like, it's not that I thought they were saying something else. Like, I never thought about it. I was right, like, right, that's just the sound this that was, they make this during wasn't this
some
song.
Mystery, like the lyrics of Louie Louie.
Right.
Yeah, it's a great song. Best horn use in any, they're their horn band of any other songs, just incredible, great chorus. They'll love September.
Yep.
So at number five, we've got Climax Blues Band, Couldn't Get It Right, from their album Gold Plated. This song was actually written after their label told them Gold Plated didn't have a standout track and asked them to write a hit. Now, this is funny. They wrote it in the words of bassist Derek Holt from absolutely nowhere. And the sudden emergence of this song pissed off their producer because he was convinced that they were withholding a hit song from him. Like, big fight. But this was a huge song, number three in the Billboard Hot 100. I love the lead guitar part on this. It's as catchy as anything in the song. You know, this is a weird one too, because this is one of those, there are songs like, there's another one on here actually, where it has a really tricky chorus, because like, this is a song where the chorus is not like, there are choruses where it's like, look at me, I'm the chorus. You know what I mean? Like, you know that it's the chorus, it's big, it's catchy. This one is the one that ended up stuck in my head the most after listening to this soundtrack, but it's not like a big chorus. It's like, it's a very muted chorus. You know what I mean? Like, it's not bombastic. It's just like this very understated chorus. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. At the very least, it's not like outwardly hooky. It is kind of like funny to think of that as being like, some producer be like, you were sitting on this, because it's not like a crazy hook. It's just a good song. Like,
yeah.
It's not like name any huge chorus song. Like, it's just like it's a kind of surprising. It was a big hit, honestly. But yeah,
it's so funny to imagine the scene where, you know, you've put together an album's worth of music, you know, and you're proud of it. And then Hash is like, where's the hit?
Right. Yeah. Like, I don't hear it. Yeah.
Where's the hit? And then you're like, I guess I'll write another song, asshole.
I'm going to call a songwriter from under the Silver Lake unless you come up with something good. We love it. We love the songwriter, though. He's very talented.
Oh, shit. So up next, we've got Al Green, Love and Happiness, from his album, I'm Still in Love with You. This was so High Records didn't release the this as a single at the time it came out. They released the title track, Look What You've Done For Me and For the Good Times, but the song ended up gaining popularity in the US from radio play. And his performance of this song on Soul Train solidified this as a big hit, but this was not released. They didn't want to put this one out as a single because at the time his record sales had begun to flag. And this song only peaked at number 104 on the Billboard charts prior to that, but ended up becoming a pretty big hit afterwards.
Afraid of the horny levels.
Yeah.
Well,
they are exponential. Like, that level of horniness, even for the 1970s, was not normal.
Well, and like, I mean, look, anyone who knows my taste in music knows I'm going to love this song. It's fucking Al Green. What I like about this one is there's like a head fake at the start. It feels like it's going to be like a big old ballad. You know what I mean? And then that drum kicks in and that guitar and the synth and the horns, and it just becomes this like great horny Al Green song. You know what I mean?
I had this moment listening to it. So this is the song, I think they got me into Al Green. I'm a big fan of Al Green. Hearing it in this movie, I had the thought, I was like, is this my favorite song? Like, is this the song I like the most out of any song? And I don't know if it's true, but I don't know that it's not true either. It is just that, because this is they play this over the end credits, right?
Right.
Yeah. And it was like, I guess it's just, you know, the satisfaction of having watched this movie and then hearing that, I was just sort of like, I want to feel like this all the time. Like, I just love it.
Yeah, it's honestly great one to hang your hat on if you're choosing a favorite song of all time. You know what I mean? Like, it's a you've made a good choice. So at number seven, we've got Brick with Daz from their album Good High. It was their biggest hit, spent 4 weeks on the R&B charts, reached number three on the Billboard Hot 100, 41 on the Billboard Year End chart. This is a funny story about this one from today, actually. I stopped at my dad's cable service provider today to pay his bill, and this song was playing, but my lizard brain thought they were listening to No Vaseline for about 10 seconds.
Well, I had the same thought, because I knew there's a big sample from the beginning of this. There's like a couple of different, I guess, 8-bar samples that have been used. And I was like, what song do I know this from? So I looked up who sampled it. And it's like, it's been sampled 81 times.
Dude, it's
according
insane.
To who sampled it. So I was like, I definitely knew it from No Vaseline. I think I also knew it from a Dos Effects song. But then, like, the more I looked, I was like, I've heard this 1,000 times in my life.
Yeah, and the song itself, right? That's the thing, because like, immediately I was like, you fucking idiot, you've listened to this song 12 times this week, and why would they be listening to No Vaseline at this little cable?
It is a bit of a vibe killer. It's scaring the hose and stuff.
Well, it's easy to see why this was sampled so much, because this song already sort of plays on a loop, you know what I mean? That doo-doo-doo, it's just that. And then, you know, you throw the hand claps in, baby, I'm in. Like, I love that shit. Yeah, it's a great song. Great song. Number eight, we've got Earth, Wind, and Fire with Boogie Wonderland from their album I Am. Another one that peaked at number four, huge hit, peaked at 14 on the Billboard Dance Chart, 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. Certified gold in the US, platinum in the UK, Grammy nominated for Best Disco Song and Best R&B Instrumental Performance. which is when the Grammys had like 800 categories.
Yeah.
But you know what's funny about this song? This song almost feels like a disco parody that it's all somehow ended up being really good. Like it has like, you know what I mean? Like it almost feels like they're parodying disco here, but this like is, the song is great.
This is the one song that feels to me like a little, you know, needle droppy, because it's like, this is like a song that I feel like if you're going to make a movie now set in the 70s, this is what you open like a party scene with.
Right.
Like it, because I mean, it's just like really recognizable opening.
In lieu of the title card that says Los Angeles, 1977, you
yeah.
can play this and everybody's like, oh, all right.
Yeah. Or not even, it's like right. more like, it's more like when Dirk Diggler goes from Torrance, California to the first like big party, you're like, this is like what the music is going to be.
Yeah.
Like as he's walking up the driveway.
And I didn't check whatever. It, but I believe this is also in Boogie Nights. There's a couple of songs on the soundtrack that are. And so like, I had the same association. I do wonder to what extent it is like, is it too needle droppy, or is it just that this is one of the most overstated songs made during the 1970s and there's no like subtle way yeah. to, you know, use Boogie Wonderland?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's it's both.
Yeah.
And like any song, the first time it's used to set a particular kind of scene is like a great selection. And then the second time you're like, wasn't this in Boogie Nights?
Right.
Or yep. whatever. And so, you know, it just, what's really lazy about like the current kind of needle drop stuff is just how, you know, indistinct, you know, tent pole movies are from, you know, like a car commercial.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah. they're just choosing this, like they are just deciding that the audience is too stupid to have a broader palette. To, you know, a broader audio palette. So they're just going to be like, remember this one.
Yeah.
It has and that like, same, and yeah, it's not Earth, Wind and Fire's fault, but that's how I think Boogie Wonderland has fallen into that.
Yeah,
from the pre-awareness way it's trap.
Yeah.
Right. I actually, my final, it's, I forgot that this is, I did these notes a few days ago. I forgot that my final note was, I could absolutely see myself having like a 250 over 120 blood pressure because I'm coked out of my gills on a dance floor at a disco, like getting down to this song.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Right here, and I'm like having a heart attack on the dance floor or something. But okay, so that leads us to number 9, Bee Gees' Jive Talkin' from their album Main Course. This song is originally called Drive Talking in its early stage, and this is funny, there's a little bit of
rhythm. They were recording it for like a GMC Gremlin ad, and they were like, this is too good. It's too good.
they modeled,
they saw Airplane.
they modeled the song's sound after the sound their car made when they would cross the Julia Tuttle Causeway every day on the way to the studio. Now, when they released this song, they delivered it in a plain white cover with no indication of what the song's name was or who sang it. And DJs would only find out when they played it and placed it on the turntable. And this was the second time they did this. They did this with, to get Airplane for the music, they did it with their first U.S. single, New York Mining Disaster, 1941 and 1967. And this one had two chart climbs after Saturday, once as a single, and then later when Saturday Night Fever came out, it hit number one on the Billboard chart both times. I said this when I talked about the Bee Gees before, but I'm really glad it's that they're cool now. You know what I mean? Like, I because disco got a hard time. Bee Gees got a hard time, but like, fuck, could they write a hit? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, this isn't my favorite of theirs, but it is, it, as you said, like it's just like precision crafted to be the number one song in the United States of America. Can't beat it that way, you know.
Well, and what I like about this one too, though, is that like, because they were deep in their disco ways, you know, this was like, this drops the huge sound and excesses of stuff like Stayin' Alive. You know what I mean? It's almost like a hybrid of their early shit before they went disco and their disco stuff, which I do like about this one, because I like early Bee Gees before they went disco too. So it's kind of like this like meeting in the middle, even though it is very firmly disco, but like, you know what I mean? It's not, put this next to any of their big, big fucking hits. And like, it's very different.
Yeah, this one is just, you know, I mean, it's not like I haven't heard Bee Gees songs that I like, but this one I just find just kind of boring.
Yeah.
And just, it doesn't, I just hear that. And like when I was going through the soundtrack, I was like, okay, we're going to go to number 10 now.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a shame.
I was like, I don't know that I want to listen to the lyrics closely. I feel like I'll feel bad about it if I do.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to move forward.
That's also that becomes a much colder own when you find out what song number 10 is.
Yeah,
that's sure. That's what I was going to say. Number 20.
Which, not to step on Eric's line.
No. You. It is a funny time to say that because, the song is Kiss's Rock and Roll All Night from their album Dressed to Kill. A huge song for them. And my only notes for this song were fuck Kiss. I hate Kiss. Suck.
Yeah. It's awful.
It's like really
worst band of all time. No
it
question.
It is like, and it's just really sad.
Yeah. It's like it's rock and roll with no rock and roll in it. Like it just is. Yeah. I mean, I guess, again, it belongs in the soundtrack because it's like it's what you would hear if you were driving around. I mean, you still hear it, I think, more often than you should in the culture in general. But woof. Yeah. Like just anything to do with Kiss is bad times to me. But this one especially is just like, has that like the way that all like bad theatrical 70s rock does, where it just like it feels like musical theater to me. Like it just feels corny.
Yeah. I mean, this is,
I guess it is.
When AI starts making music, they're going to remake Kiss.
Yep. Yeah. Basically, it's like, honestly, the weirder part is that people ever came up with it.
That might be the best encapsulation of Kiss I've ever heard in my life, by the way, Charles, that like this is like the band that AI would create. Okay. Yep, that's enough wrong. Kiss. Number 11, the band Ain't Got No Home from their album Moondog Matinee, which is a cover of a song by Clarence Frogman Henry. Again, cover question songs.
I was going to say, I'm like, I love the Frogman version. I don't know why you'd use a different one. Not that you can go wrong using the band. The band is awesome, but the Frogman version is just like, they got to the part where he's like, I'm just a lonely frog. And it's just not as good as the original.
Yeah, it's a funny bit in the movie because a loaded Ryan Gosling doing the woo part is funny, but I think I'd assumed it was the version that I knew, which was the Clarence Henry one, and then to hear it's like it's one of those like sort of like ultra mannered like bumpkin face band songs where they're kind of like trying really hard to make sure that you don't know they're Canadian in a way that makes it more embarrassing to hear.
Yeah,
for a band that I think is excellent, the band that had a lot of lousy songs or just like corny, weird, overdetermined songs, and this version is one of those to me.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you're gonna do, you know, Ain't Got No Home, and you're gonna do, because you have to, the frog verse, you better be able to really get down and do a gravelly frog.
Yeah, you have to be willing to get in the shit.
You have to do like your voice has to drop into registers that really kind of blow out the bass on somebody's speaker. You have to sound like you've never stopped drinking. It's gotta be rough. You know, you're a pack a day guy if you're gonna do that frog, and he's just not. And so like that part hit and I was like, wait, is this not even him?
Yeah.
And it was not.
Copyright compliant unlicensed version there. Yeah, so if we're going by Eric standards for covers, I think they do fuck it up.
Yeah,
I see. I'm not as hard on this one as you are, but I have 100% agree that the Frogman version, I mean, it's fucking the Frogman version has that Manish Boy, like I love Manish Boy too, you know what I mean? It's got that same sort of like just that, oh, it's so good. But
and I mean, this is the contemporaneous discourse, right? Like as we're recording this, we are in the middle of Luke, you know, the discussion of Luke Combs covering Fast Car.
Yeah.
And like his version's not bad. It's just like, and I don't blame him at all, right? He does it respectfully and kind of reverently and loves the original. And, you know, it's just his version is just kind of edgeless. And, you know, there's no reason for it to be made other than the fact that he can, you know, he wants to do a song that he likes. And the only reason it's popular is for uncomfortable reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
And because it's like a great song to start. I mean, like the bones are good, you know?
Yes.
Like,
yeah. Sure. Well, which you're working on a strong frame.
Yep.
Yeah.
So up next at number 12, we've got Rupert Holmes with Escape, the Pina Colada song from the album Partners in Crime. This song peaked at number one on December of 1979 to become the final U.S. number one song of the 70s. So there's funny, this song became what it was. So the chorus originally started with "If You Like Humphrey Bogart," which Holmes changed at the last minute, replacing the actor with the name of it, the very first exotic cocktail that came to his mind. And the original lyric said, "If you like Humphrey Bogart and getting caught," and this is a quote from him. The original lyric said, "If you like Humphrey Bogart and getting caught in the rain." And as I was on the mic, I thought to myself, and I don't know much about Rupert Holmes, so this is very funny to me. "I've done so many movie references to Bogart and widescreen cinema on my earlier albums. Maybe I shouldn't do one here." And I get, was that like his thing? He had like a Humphrey Bogart shtick where he would like talk about Humphrey Bogart in like a lot of songs. Like
he's Michael Bolton with the Pirates of the Caribbean. Yeah.
Now back to the good part.
The thing about this song too is this is a song I feel like I should hate like Cheeseburger in Paradise or something, but I have like some really great associations with this song. First and foremost is Dirty Work, the bar fight scene in Dirty Work. But even with that aside, this is a catchy song. Like I can't help but love it. Like it's sort of like 70s arena rock with an island vibe song. It's another one that I'm amazed was a huge hit though, listening to it.
It's just sort of kind of funny as a time capsule, right? Like I didn't listen to the whole thing for the purposes of the podcast. So I'm just sort of going from memory, but it's like the joke is like, it's like the kind of dawn of personal ads, right? Like this is like really early personal ad days. And so it's kind of a riff on that. And isn't it like, doesn't he basically find his own like
partner? Yeah, the answer is the ad is his own loving lady.
Yeah. Yep. You know, and so it's just like really, it's a good gag. Like it's
sweet.
Fun.
It's like it's a very like sort of 70s-y thing, and it's not to well, this is already putting too much weight on a song that is like literally 2 minutes long. But it's like the whole gag there is that like, you know, he wants to be out there like getting some strange and doing some, you know, like self-actualized 70s male shit, but it turns out that all he really wants is to be with his own loving lady and to go for walks and like share oversweet drinks at like some bar with ferns in it and shit. So it's a duality of the 1979 experience, I feel like, as somebody who was months old in 1979. I can't really speak with much authority on it, but it feels right.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little older than that, but also not dated.
Right, I was going to say, we're neither one of us.
No, that could go for a very long time. I was going to say. We're stretching into the 90s. Yeah. Really.
One final thing on this, I forgot to mention this earlier, is that as of 2019, Rupert Holmes claims that he's actually never tried a pina colada in his entire life. Like, I don't know. So that leads us to number 13, Andrew Gold's Lonely Boy from the album What's Wrong With This Picture. It spent 5 months on the American charts, peaked at number 7 in U.S. in Canada. My first notes on this were literally just, I love the word love 10 times this song. Like, this is like 70s AM radio rock filtered through power pop. It's like, there's like two things that it's just so much my shit. It's such an impeccably crafted song. That chorus is huge. Then it adds that like his, I don't know. There's just so many things I like about the way the song's produced. Like the verses are just piano and drums, but it adds like these layers to the chorus and it blasts his vocals to the front of the mix. It starts leaning on that guitar midway through. I love the song. If I haven't made that clear yet, I fucking love Lonely Boy.
So I didn't lose it to this one the way that you did, but it is like, this is also in Boogie Nights. And so I had a sort of fond association with that as well, but it is like, even if it didn't like hit me that hard, it was the sort of thing where like I was like nodding as I was listening to it. I was like, all right, good choice. Or like, oh, that's smart. Like, good to bring the guitars in there. Like, it is extremely well made. And it had that kind of like, I don't, there's like a part of me, you know, whatever. Again, maybe this is just being old or maybe it's listening to old things where I like, I check down really quick to like, we used to make things in this country, you know? Like, but there is like an aspect to this where I was just like, look at this. Everybody knew exactly what they were fucking doing. All the session musicians are in the pocket. The production's just right. And it's like, even though the song kind of, it doesn't leave me flat, it is the sort of thing where it's like, it's, you know, like all we do now is just fucking, you know, they do the iPhones. Everybody's making phones. But this is, there is like an element of craftsmanship to this that I respect.
Oh,
this is this just falls into the category of take it or leave it. And I felt really bad because you're so heartfelt about it. And you even previewed how heartfelt you were about it. And all I could think about was that it's off the album, Thank You for Being a Friend. And I was like, that's so funny. That's the theme from the Golden Girls. And then I looked it up and it's literally the theme from the
It is literally the theme.
He wrote the theme from the Golden Girls.
Yep.
So and I was just like, oh man.
The first time I heard the song outside of the Golden Girls context, I remember it was at a amusement park in Springfield, Massachusetts. I was there with my summer camp and I was on the spinning teacups. And it was like that song was playing the Andrew Gold version of Thank You for Being a Friend, which is like this song, like heavily produced AM radio shit, like a little more muscular than the theme version of Golden Girls. Is like, what does that mean? That's like basically it's like saying that Paul Giamatti's like a little more ripped than like
Let me just say that if I were on a teacups ride and I heard a 4.5 minute version of the Golden Girls theme, I would assume that it had killed me.
Yep.
That it had spun too fast and I had just died.
It was the sort of thing where it was like the first thought in my head was don't barf. And then the second thought was, this is the Golden Girls theme, right? Like this is, they just did a different version of it. They did like a rockin' version of it.
I died on the teacups.
Yep.
That gets carved on the grave.
I will say that so that is a funny bit that you just did. The part that I thought you were going for, because you were speaking fairly slowly, was like, if I were on the spinning teacups and something or other, I was like, if this motherfucker says, I would see the biggest gift would be from me and the card attached would say, thank you for being a friend. I'm going to leave this podcast right now.
No.
oh shit. Well, I mean, it's cool. I just find, you know, I know this song's not the thing for everybody, but this is like, I'm very much a sucker for shit like this sort of song. So, Charles, I'll just edit out you saying bad things about it. So, number 14, we've got America with A Horse with No Name from their self-titled debut album. This was a huge hit, topped the charts of Canada, Finland, the U.S. So trying to find this background behind this one, trying to find a song that would be both popular in the U.S. and Europe, Warner Brothers was reluctant to release the song I Need You, which from their first single from America. And they asked the band if they had any other material and arranged for America to write 4 more songs at Morgan Studios in London. And they wrote this song in that time. And it was originally called Desert Song. It was written while they were in the home of Arthur Brown in Dorset, England. The first two demos were recorded there, and they were intended to capture the sensation of a hot, dry desert that they had seen in a Salvador Dali painting. That's where they. So here's the thing about this song. I like Horse with No Name. It's overplayed, but in a just world, Sister Golden Hair would be America's signature song. Like, that is their song. That is, to me, their best song by like a fucking mile. It's way better than Horse with No Name.
Yeah, I don't know their stuff that well, but it is kind of a bummer that this is a band that like had a lot of hits and put out a lot of records, and their best song is like, you know, like We've Got Neil Young at Home.
It's just like, I'm a sucker for America.
Oh, I like them too.
What are you fucking running for Senate now? Jesus Christ.
All right. So, yeah, I am a sucker for America, Dave. I grew up here.
I will never apologize.
I will die here unless there's any opportunity to go.
Leave if it goes someplace funny or even just with good food.
Yeah, they're a good band, though. I like, there's a lot of songs. Ventura Highway, they have a lot of songs I like. But
them?
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you'd know if you would know Sister Golden Hair if you played it right now. You would be like, oh, that one.
No, I feel like I do know it. I think I just had, like, for whatever reason, I just like the thing I learned about this song was that it wasn't Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young. like the operative fact there.
The lyrics are really stupid too. That's another thing about this song that we're not getting into. And then we close the soundtrack with Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass Band, Green Peppers from their album Whipped Cream and Other Delights, which has a really famous album cover. This has been parodied a million times. It was a model just covered in whipped cream. But yeah, I mean, we close with a short little instrumental piece. I don't really have much to say about it. It's cool. It's cool for like the 2 minutes it plays.
Yeah.
The only thing I have to say is that it is, I associate this music very distinctly with pornography in the 70s. Like this is like what Boogie Nights era porn soundtrack basically sounds like to me. And so hearing it, I was, you know, like it's just all like, like where they had to give it kind of artistic merit. And like I mean, it's just the sound of game shows and pornography and it's like a soundtrack of the 70s in the goofiest way. No?
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. I know exactly what you mean as you're saying it. Like, I know exactly what you mean that it's like that porn. I didn't want to say I knew porn music. That was what I was trying to hide. I don't know what any of that is. I'm being marked in that scene with Judith.
That like idea of the 70s was always like very resonant to me in terms of like just like everything was kind of overstuffed and worked on. Like a lot of humans clearly were like a part of producing it, and yet the taste level was abysmal at every level, like instantly identifiable as such. And it looks like way worse now. Like the idea, like even just looking at Herb Alpert album covers, you're kind of like, damn bitch, you lived like this. Like this was right. Like you could have listened instead of like actual jazz or actual rock and roll, like you put on like just something to sit in a conversation pit to. Like this is like what that is.
So to wrap things up here, songs in the movie that aren't on the soundtrack, actually way less than I thought, because this is such a music heavy movie. I figured there'd be more, but the only ones are Captain Tennille's Muskrat Love, the Sexorama Band's Money Shot, Austin Carter Roundup's East of Midnight, and K-Star's Everybody's Waiting for the Man with the Bag. Is it on Spotify? Yeah, the entire thing, actually. Like I said, these are a bunch of standards. So all this stuff is on Spotify, and someone put it in a handy playlist where it's exactly as it is on the album. All right, so let me ask you, whoever wants to go first can go first here. The movie, would you consider this movie an essential? Would you say stream it, or would you say skip it?
Oh, this is an essential.
Yeah. Yeah. I think so, too. Yeah. Not just so that you can like do spoofs and goofs with your friends and like get other people's bits. It's just fucking great. It's a great way to spend 2 hours. Like just a really fun movie that will make you like Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling more than you do probably.
And, you know, I mean, David said his wife just has no memory of it, but I will say it's a certified wife movie.
Yep.
Like, you know, it's two hunks in the leading roles. And it is super funny. And all of it's like not one of those things where like there's shit that guys think is funny and the women who are with them are like, you are a child.
Right.
It's, you know, we were both just laughing through the whole movie, and it's just great. Yeah. This is great. And I just don't want a bad one.
Yeah. I think also for us as like now that we are all certified nice guys perverts who've watched it multiple times, like as rewatchable as any movie that I have seen, like just a delight the second time. I mean, Charles, you saw it 2 times in a week. Like you dug it as much the second time as the first, I'm gathering.
Well, I mean, I watched them too close together to dig it just as much, but I was watching it the second time to like actually take notes so I wouldn't miss the parts that I loved. And you know, there were things that I caught the second time because they only made sense on the second viewing, you know, like all of the casual things, like, you know, they go over the Comedy Store a couple of times. And so I paused so I could see the marquee.
Yeah.
Which was Robert Klein, Richard Lewis, Tim Allen, and Elaine Boozler.
Yeah. Tim Allen one's so funny.
Yep.
Yeah. And then at the end, they show the Comedy Store again and he's headlining the second time. You know, like all of that stuff and like all of the little gags really do hold up both times, you know, like when they're drunk at the end and they're, you know, and he's like, and Gosling is like, nobody got hurt. And he's like, a couple people got hurt.
He's like, yes. I have that in my notes as actually a lot of people got hurt. Maybe that's just what's implied.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He might have said that. No, he might have said, my note only says nobody got hurt. So yeah. I don't remember the exact thing. Like, you learn that every joke like actually has a callback, because there was a callback to the Hitler thing even,
yeah,
you know, when like they're having the conversation at the end and Gosling starts speaking gibberish German noises,
yeah,
you know, because again, he's like Hitler following orders. You know, like everything gets a callback. And so it really does stand up to more than once because it's so good.
Yeah. I think I've made it clear that I consider this an essential too at this point. I need to give my rating, but it is an essential.
Yep. Yep.
So the sound.
I'll fucking say it if no one else is going to say it. It's better than Babs.
Is it a contest? Is yes. Yes, in fact, it is definitely a contest. It's better.
I don't want to make them fight. That's my thing.
Yeah.
I
love all my room for both. I love all cinema.
Boy, they are going to talk about this on the Landau forum.
they're dragging you on the Landau forums.
All right. So the soundtrack, essential, stream it, skip it, or cherry pick certain songs from it.
I mean, it's good music from a good era. You know, like you're listening to this music anyway. I don't know that the soundtrack is essential.
I agree. I mean, it's like it's all songs you know and like. I mean, if you think of it as a playlist, like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, but right. You need to like seek it out because it's going to remind you of the Nice Guys. It's like whenever you saw the Nice Guys for the first time, you'd heard each of these songs 100 times before that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really sort of elaborate packaging for the vinyl seems like very cool and also just like a very disappointing thing to have happen to a movie that didn't pop the way you'd think it should.
Yeah.
You know, like instead of it being a collector's item, it's like an item.
Yep.
Yeah. 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 And I'm in agreement here. Like, I mean, it's like song by song, a lot of these songs are like essential songs. And as a collection, it's a great collection. But like, like I said, I hear these songs on my local radio station 3 times a week. You know what I mean? So like, but it's a streamer. I mean, it's right there on Spotify. Like if you're looking for a good oldies radio station playlist, it's right there. So like, yep. You know, streamer for sure. Do the two go well together? The songs and the movie?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they do. Everything fits the movie, you know, and you know, it's all good stuff. You know, I like, there's just not something to say about it.
Yeah, except for Kiss. Right. If you're building a period piece, you know, you got to have music that kind of lets you feel like you're in that period. And I think this does so.
Yeah. And I mean, every period has a song that sucks.
Yep.
all right. Top 3 songs on the soundtrack. Whoever wants to go first can go first. Top 3.
Obviously, I guess I sort of tip my hand there that it could be Love and Happiness 3 times to me. Like, because I love it dearly. But I would I'd say that one is number one by a decent margin. Papa Was a Rolling Stone, obviously fantastic. And then it's a question of like, I think that, you know, obviously I don't want to challenge Bobby's title for getting the same song 2 times. I'm sure that I had Get Down on it like at or near the top of my ranking for Baps too. And in this case, I would not hesitate to put it up there either 2 or 3 again in this one.
Great song. I don't blame you. Yeah. Charles, what's your top 3?
All right. So number 1, September. Number 2, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. And number 3, I'm just going with a wild card here, and I'm going to just say Herb Alpert.
This is from his smash album, The Sound of Pornography, while Gerald Ford is president.
It just reminds me of a time when I was watching pornography.
All right.
Were we ever so young?
Further watching, further listening.
There was so much hair.
Oh, all right. So further watching, further listening recommendation. Shane Black's catalog, really. We talked about this a little bit earlier, but he has such a distinct stamp that he leaves on his stuff. Long Kiss Goodnight, Last Boy Scout, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, Lethal Weapon, Last Action Hero. I mean, it's very much Shane Black movies are very much Shane Black movies, whether he wrote them or wrote and directed them. And I would say also just for one that's not Shane Black, Kid Detective is kind of funny like this with Adam Brody. That's kind of a fun one that I would suggest. It kind of like works the same way where it's like some sort of down in his luck, not supposed to be doing this guy working as a detective on a case. And then as far as further listening, Temptations album, All Directions, Andrew Gold's album, What's Wrong With This Picture, and Al Green's I'm Still In Love With You are all great albums beyond just the songs that are present on this soundtrack. So that's, yeah, that's my suggestions today. And then I guess we're at the point where we promo and, you know, we give promotions. It's floor is yours now. I'll go in order here. David, you go first. Tell everyone where they can find you, what you've got going on.
Sure. I work at defector.com. That's a website you can subscribe to. You can read some stuff for free if you would like to do that before you subscribe, which I'd understand. But yeah, it's we're doing it. We're coming up on our third birthday in September. It's working. We're still having fun and posts are good. And I don't know. I've been enjoying that. And then podcast wise, as you mentioned at the top of the show, 3.5 hours ago, I do The Distraction with Drew McGarry and I do It's Christmas Town with Jeb Lund. One of those has to do with Hallmark movies. You can probably figure out which. The other one is just me and Drew talking to whoever we talk to. But yeah, I'm blessed to be doing all of those things. And I hope that you will enjoy consuming that content if you choose to do so.
And you're on Blue Sky now too, right?
Like, I am. Yeah. Same, at David_J_Rob. I'm still posting on Twitter while I need to see the numbers go up. I don't feel great about it, but it's just the way my brain is now, you know?
I get it.
But yes, I am on Blue Sky. Together we can make Blue Sky less bad.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to use it more. I really am.
Yeah, you got to be the change you want to see.
Well, we talked about this before the show started, and then Charles went off on a whole racist tangent. It was really weird, but
I didn't say it was racial. I don't know if it was racist. But,
yeah, well, I appreciate you getting canceled with me, David.
Yep.
All right, Charles, where can they find you?
Well, they can find me at stormfront.com. no, I edit that out. So they,
Charles,
don't edit that out. The no, you can find me basically on Twitter at UGarls and on Blue Sky at UGarls. And hopefully, you know, like I say this all the time, we're just too busy to record A-Lab, but we're going to keep recording A-Lab eventually.
Hell yeah.
And there's, there's a Christmas Town somewhere in audio engineering hell. Episode. You know, it's like this great lost episode that we're hoping is done in time for actual Christmas season.
We literally recorded it during last Hanukkah.
Yeah. And we're just, you know, it'll be the anniversary of recording that it'll be released. It'll be like one of those really special things. I mean, it took 17 years for The Nice Guys to come out. So yep. What can you do?
We're going to redo the whole thing where I'm going to write all of Charles's gags and he's going to write all of mine.
So that's it.
I mean, presidency.
That's it. I will just do anyone out there. I will do your podcast.
He's the best in the business. You should bring him in.
It's obvious that you will do anyone's podcast because you've been on here twice. Like, it's very obvious at this point. Everyone yes. Knows do whatever the fuck's thrown your way.
Yeah, it was redundant.
Right. I don't watch movies or listen to music. And look at me.
All right, guys, it was really awesome having you back. And I'm so fucking glad that we did The Nice Guys, because this is one that I've been like really wanting to do. And it just felt like you guys, I kind of brought this up to you a while ago. How'd you feel about The Nice Guys? And glad we did it.
Yep.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Best homework ever.
Yep. Did it.
All right. Well, I'll let you guys go. Have a great night. And everyone listening at home, thank you for checking out the show. And as always, I hope that you have a tremendous weekend.
Thanks. Right. Bye.
Good night, all.
Ain't no use running. Ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. You're a movie with original songs. The soundtrack, I'm gonna track you down.